Support for Boston Public Radio comes from MBA Builders, partnering with clients to help bring the home they envision to life. Their design-build approach involves your project manager from initial consultation through completion. MBA Builders, building relationships. Build with MBA.com. And North Shore Music Theater. Audiences can experience the true story and musical journey of Frankie Valli in the Four Seasons. Jersey Boys comes to Bill Haney's North Shore Music Theater May 7th through May 19th. Tickets at nsmt.org.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, could Trump spontaneously combust before this impeachment inquiry makes real inroads that is unraveling? Yesterday's press conference betray how the process is consuming him. We kick things off with Chuck Todd asking if we're seeing Trump come unglued or if this is Trump just appealing to his base. Then we open the lines and ask you about these three words, I forgive you. That's what Brant Jean said to Amber Geiger, that's a former cop who fatally shot his brother, during the victim impact statement. Is this profound display of grace something you aspire to or something you could never do?
Inclusion is a big word these days, but people with disabilities remain locked out of the conversation. The documentary Intelligent Lives aims to change this. We talked to its executive producers, Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper, about what they had to do to fight for their son, labeled intellectually challenged and disabled. That's next on Boston Public Radio. He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I apologize again for my voice. I'll be better tomorrow. Good morning, Jim.
Another uneventful day in America, Marjorie. So with the impeachment inquiry escalating, so too are Trump's tantrums. Yesterday, if you missed this, boy, you really missed it. He managed to outdo himself, unleashing his id in this bizarro joint press conference with a Finnish president who was sucked into the drama. One reporter asked what favors President Trump had demanded of him. Joining us on the line to go over the latest on this and other political headlines is Chuck Todd. Chuck's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston. That's Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Hello, Chuck Todd.
Well, how are you? And Marjorie, I have a voice issue, too.
You do?
Mine is the fault of the Nats. So.
The Nationals.
Oh,
congratulations.
Yeah, for a good reason. Yeah, it's nice. You know, we'll see what happens.
Okay, but, too much screaming from the couch for you, Chuck?
Yes. No, I was at the game.
Good for you. Good.
No, it was earned. I earned it. I earned it the hard way.
Okay, I'm glad that the Nationals, when you talked about the Nats, I thought you were talking about flies there for a minute, Chuck Todd.
And now
I know.
G-N-A-T-S,
I know the lingo. Yeah. I know the lingo. So
we got those Nats here, too. We named them here. They have different names. They're usually members of Congress.
You know, Chuck Todd, you watch presidents much more closely than I have, but I stood in my kitchen yesterday watching that entire Trump press conference, and I was sort of shell-shocked. What did you make of the press conference when, of course, the president was sitting next to the president of Finland, who was probably a little shell-shocked, too? Was it unusual?
Was it unusual? you say so passively. Is it unusual? That sounds like how the Queen Elizabeth would describe it. Well, the American president, he's quite unusual.
Well, I just was shocked.
I say this, Margaret, I say it with love. I'm with you. I don't know. There are no more words. We've run out of words to describe his behavior. I think it's clear, you know, he's cornered and he's acting like somebody who's cornered. I had made this observation to my wife. I said, you know, here's what impeachment is going to do. We are going to see the worst version of Trump. Okay, the worst version of what he is when he gets defensive and he gets cornered and he feels as if he's under siege, it surfaces the worst version of him. And that's what we're experiencing right now is this worst version of him. That's what we saw yesterday. And I think it is quite scary. You don't know. I think here's the point. You don't know what he's going to say. I don't think he's going to do anything crazy. But I think he could say anything at any moment at this point, and it would shock no one. And I think that what our job's really got to be is explain that Why is he behaving this way? He's behaving this way because he's been caught. And look, I think the most damning moment yesterday, and I think one that has not been repeated enough because it's at the central core of this entire controversy, is when he was just asked point blank by Jeff Mason, the reporter from Reuters.
That's great.
Well, what did you hope the president of Ukraine would do about the Bidens? And the fact that it triggered that tirade rather than for fear, because he had no answer to that question. And if he can't answer that question, he cannot, you know, we know why he can't answer that question. So I think I'm worried we're all going to get caught up in his behavior rather than realizing he's just essentially admitting something in plain sight.
Well, here's the thing to me, Chuck Todd. The president would not answer the question yesterday. Here's a little bit of sound of the president who did answer the question, standing next to Marine One with all the wind on the lawn of the White House. Here it is.
The conversation I had was largely congratulatory, was largely corruption, all of the corruption taking place, was largely the fact that we don't want our people, like Vice President Biden and his son, creating to the corruption already in the Ukraine. And Ukraine's got a lot of problems.
Here's what I don't understand. We're getting wrapped up in the transcript and what the whistleblower did and didn't do and all these other peripheral things about what Adam Schiff did and didn't do. The president he wouldn't answer it yesterday because I think he's realized how damaging it is, but he already answered it, didn't he?
He absolutely did. By the way, the call couldn't have been largely congratulatory and largely about Biden and largely about corruption, right? Like, you can't, like, it has to be not largely about something. Why do I have a feeling the congratulations part was the part that may have not been so large? Anyway, I love some of his choice of words because it's limited. And when he finds one he likes, he just uses it over and over and over and over again. Anyway, sorry, I digress. I largely digress. But I don't know. Here's what I think we're all wondering is, why is it that Republicans are just sitting here throwing up their hands and sticking their head in the sand? Because that's exactly what they're doing.
So that exactly was where I was going to go. When they watch yesterday, we all have heard what the retired Jeff Flake, now at the Kennedy School, said the other day. What did he say? You can get a new job, you can't get a new soul, or something like that.
Yeah.
What is the thinking in their caucuses, in their cloakrooms, after watching a performance like yesterday, after watching a strategy which appears to be to ignore, not comply, all those sort of things? Where are they? I don't mean where are they on the ultimate question, assuming he gets to the Senate. Where are they on the strategy, on the approach of the Republican president?
I think, you know, most are upset that it looks like the White House isn't doing enough on this. But here's where most of these Republicans are. They made their deal already, right? Whatever rationale they've given themselves for sticking by him, if they now, you know, it's sort of like you've gone this far, and I think for some of them, they're not ready for that pain that comes with breaking now, right? You know, there's always going to be pain when you break it, you know, and they clearly, and the longer they delay it, the more painful the split will be. So I think they've spent so much time rationalizing their support for Trump that in a weird way, it's now gotten easy for them. They now in their own minds, oh, I've figured this out. I know what to ignore. I know what not to comment on. I know when to not walk the hallways of the Senate so that a reporter doesn't bump into me. You know, now for the life of me, I don't know why. I mean, I assume anybody that ran to be a United States senator loves history. Okay, loves American history and has read the history books and has read about, you know, I don't understand why somebody runs for office to stay in office, right? I thought you ran for office to do something and to sometimes do something at a moment that's hard. And in a weird way, I thought you were narcissistic enough and egomaniacal enough to run for office to think you wanted to be at that moment. And here you are. You're at a moment. You're in a moment of history, and you're, you know, you're going to not be there when the historians write about it.
Well, you're speaking about a class of people, too, Republicans. It's not even one. What I wake up with every day is not that all of a sudden the Republicans in the Senate or all the Republicans in the House have an epiphany, but that one doesn't have an epiphany and behave in the way you're describing. I mean, I just, you know, we've talked about Romney, who doesn't even have to face the voters for 5 years. And, you know, he was, what did he say, extremely troubling if the facts are borne out or whatever. But, you know, so that's the Republican side. Can we talk about the Democratic side for a minute? We get angry email every time I say this, but I'll say it again today. The two public moments for the Democrats so far, those hearings, Jerry Nadler embarrassed himself in the Judiciary Committee when Corey Lewandowski embarrassed himself. And I thought that mobster thing from Adam Schiff was an abomination when you're talking about impeachment of the president of the United States of America. Are you convinced they're ready for this battle here?
No, I'm not. And I think that Pelosi, I don't understand why she didn't create a select committee.
Nor do
I. Which would have meant cherry picking, making sure you have your best interrogators, your best prosecutors turn members of Congress. There is an incredible group out there. Why is it that we're not seeing them? You know, you take your Abigail Spanbergers, your Alyssa Slotkins. Those are the people I want to see on these hearings with national security credentials in the previous administration. You know, they come at this with real depth. I just think that in that sense, she's been too much of an institutionalist, and that's who, that's in some ways that's who she is, right? You know, committee chairs work hard to become committee chairs, and she wants to give them their due. But I don't know if they're up to it. I don't. And you know, Adam Schiff is one of those guys who 80% of the time does a good, job. But there's 20% of the time where he seems to get sucked into his own politics. Like, you know, it's funny. It's like, what makes Adam Schiff to me an effective congressman is that he doesn't seem like an egomaniacal congressman. And it's the moments when it seems like he wants some attention, right, that he makes his mistakes. It's like when he's trying to act like stop acting like a politician, Adam, right? Do what you are. Be the kind of wonky prosecutor type. Stick to it. That's your thing. You know, that's a good thing. That's not a bad thing to be. Embrace it. Don't be afraid of it.
Talking to Chuck Todd from Meet the Press.
You know, the other thing I'm wondering, Chuck, if there might be, since we haven't seen it from the elected Republicans, some truth-teller, whistleblower types that will step forward. Because to me, you know, we all love our country, and everybody wants to see the United States do well. But what you're faced with, it seems right now, is the Department of Justice under the president's political control, the Department of State under the president's political control. I learned this morning that the general counsel of the CIA, to whom the whistleblower went and was very concerned about her turning all this information over to the White House, was a political appointee of President Trump. So you wonder about the control of the CIA. Not that our intelligence agencies haven't made a mistake, but now we have these people going around the world undermining the credibility of our intelligence services in general. I mean, this is scary stuff. And might there be more people who will be coming forward to confront this?
I was intrigued by two things yesterday that tell me that what you're wondering may be happening as we speak, Marjorie. First, it was the Kevin McAleenan, the acting Department of Homeland Security Secretary, who did that interview with the Post and basically threw Trump under the bus and threw the White House and said, I have operational control of this place, but, you know, it's the tone. I can't control that. It's the politics. I mean, he basically said out loud what he'd been saying privately for some time. But the fact that he felt emboldened that he could get away with it right now, right? I think that is an indication of Trump's weakness. And then you had another round of leaks about Trump and the whole alligator moat business and all
yes.
that stuff. My point is that it is I actually do think whistleblowers are contagious. And I think that, you know, you start to see some cracks, right? And I think the McAleenan, you know, here's somebody, by the way, you know, Trump, it shows you how distracted he is. He's yet to comment on it. Basically, his Homeland Security defied him, right? And he normally would have already fired the guy by now in some unceremonious tweet, but he hasn't. I just think I think we're starting to see some weakness with him inside his circle. I wouldn't Put it this way. I think in the next 6 weeks we could see more of this. And if we don't, then maybe the guy, you know, the way he handled Mueller is going to work. But I don't know.
Well, you know, when you say it's contagious, I hope it's contagious. But at the same time, when you're worried about being outed by the president and he talks about you being a treasonous, spy-like creature, it's a little...
Which is, by the way, that's intentional by the president.
Of course.
He is over the top in that rhetoric because he wants to scare people from doing this again. But ask the people in Hong, ask the Chinese government. The more you push back, sometimes the more people fight back.
I hope you're right. Yeah, Chuck. One last thing for me. The presidential race on the Democratic side has all but disappeared. What's your take on how the? I mean, there's a debate, and I guess a week and a half from now, Bernie Sanders obviously is in the hospital. I mean, what's your sense of what this all impeachment, all the time thing does to the Democratic race?
Well, look what it's already done. I mean, I think what happened with Bernie Sanders yesterday should be the single most important thing that has happened to the presidential race to date. Mm-hmm. There's some mysterious health issue. I say it's mysterious because they're being awfully vague. Yes, he had two stents put in. But, Slate, they're allowing a vacuum to be filled with articles like the one in Slate. Did Bernie Sanders have a heart attack? And by the way, he is 78. And by the way, he hasn't shared his medical stuff. And by the way, that this stuff does matter and voters do care about this. I think this I think this is the most important thing to happen to the race right now, even more so than impeachment, because I don't know what this means for Sanders going forward. I don't know how his supporters are going to react. I can tell you what has happened to other candidates that have had medical things crop up during a campaign. It has never been good. It has always been problematic. It has always cost them support. Hurt Tsongas, it hurt Bill Bradley when they both had health scares during their campaigns. It just, voters do care about these things. And I think that's now impeachment in general has certainly feels like it's frozen the race to a point where it's just all about how Biden's handling the periphery here. And, that seems to be what's going to happen is we're going to be having impeachment. We're going to cover that for the next 4 months. And once a month, it'll be interrupted by a debate.
So before you leave, when you were just speaking, I did you a favor. I did some research. If you were to run right now, you could make it to Dodger Stadium by 8:37 tonight. So maybe you just better go.
Just go now. Yeah, it would be in Forrest Gump. Just run across country.
Yeah, good for you for going to the baseball game, though. We all need some time away from this.
This Nats season, I was watching that game in fear that the Nats were going to lose and that I had no more baseball as my respite when I came home from work. I am desperate. The Nats have to at least give me October, guys. Please.
Did you see the story in the New York Times the other day about how, I think it was out of Toronto, where the games are now so long that people are taking knitting to the games to do them? So, in any case.
Oh, and playoff games are even longer. Yeah. I mean, every pitcher in the books. I know it's a problem. I'm not going to say it's not.
I think it's great right now for everybody's mental health. I mean, I feel like I'm a crack addict watching impeachment stories and reading about them. It's ridiculous.
So good luck to your team there, Chuck Todd.
Thanks. All right, guys.
Thank you very much. Chuck Todd joins us every week. He's the moderator of Meet the Press, which you can catch Sunday mornings at 10:30 on NBC Boston, Channel 10 on most providers. He's also the host of Meet the Press Daily on MSNBC and the political director for NBC News. Up next, we open the lines and ask you about Grant Zhang. He forgives Amber Geiger, the former cop who fatally shot his brother. Will you have it in you to do the same? You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. Former cop Amber Geiger has maintained she thought she had walked into her own apartment only to find an intruder. That so-called intruder was her neighbor, Botham Jean, who was actually sitting in his apartment watching TV and eating ice cream when she fatally shot him. Prosecutors argued she did not do enough to save his life after she realized what she had done. In response, Brant Jean, the brother of Botham, said this yesterday.
if you truly are sorry. I know I can speak for myself. I forgive you. And I know if you go to God and ask him, he will forgive you.
That was yesterday during his victim impact statement. I'm sure you've all seen that. He then turned to the judge somewhat nervously and asked if it was okay if he walk off the stand and hug his brother's killer. She said yes, and he did it in the middle of the courtroom floor. At age 18, as Brant Jean displayed more grace and maturity than you could expect from yourself. We're opening the lines asking you if you have it in you to forgive. 877-301-8970. Does forgiving let the forgiven off the hook, or does it set you free to forgive? What about the question of race also in all this? Is Brant Jean's display of compassion rooted in his religion, or as the Washington Post raised, is this a feel-good episode in a long history of black people extending quick absolution to white people in the face of horrific wrongs? The number is 877-301-8970. I'll tell you, the forgiveness thing is otherworldly to me, even though it's not the first time I've seen something like this. But when he turns to the judge in this case and asks if it's okay, again, nervously, because I assume he thinks she's going to say no, can he go hug Amber Geiger? He gets off the stand, walks down, they have this really intense hug. I have to say it was one of the most powerful things I have ever seen. What I did not think was appropriate, I don't know how you feel about either, when the judge came down, and it's one thing to hug, which I also thought crossed the line, the family of the man who was killed. She then walks over and hands a Bible to the defendant who's just been convicted of murder. She sentenced her to 10 years, could have been 5 to 99, and hugs her too. That, to me, totally crossed the line. I don't want to get lost. And by the way, if you want to comment on what happened in the courtroom, that is totally fine. I don't want to get lost in that. We also want to talk about in your lives, if you have it in you, because I know I surely do not have it in me, to do what this young man did, whose brother was just murdered, and the woman he wanted to hug and did hug had just been convicted of taking the life of his brother. And talk about possibilities. Did you read about this guy, both of them?
Yeah.
Was he 25 years old?
I think he was almost going to be 28 this week.
Oh, was he 28? I'm sorry.
28 this week. And he was an accountant. And I believe he had already started or had a job lined up at Price Waterhouse, one of the big seven accounting firms. So obviously a very smart, very successful young man from a fantastic family, obviously, ready to begin his life, a very successful life, and sitting on your couch eating ice cream. And this police officer who had a history of racist texts back and forth to her partner, making fun of Martin Luther King's death and that sort of thing, came in and said she was in the wrong apartment, said she thought there was an intruder, but she killed him sitting there on his couch.
So what was your take on both him saying, I forgive you, and the hug, this incredible moment?
Well, first of all, I owe a lot to you, Jim, because working with you for 20 years is... I've learned a lot
about... If you hadn't embraced the power of forgiveness.
Exactly. I've learned a lot about forgiveness. But I think, I know that we've talked about this with Irene Monroe, one of the revs that comes in with us every week, that, how come black people are always expected to forgive? And that's a great point, because you see this a lot with African-Americans. You saw it after that terrible Charlestown, South Carolina church shooting, when the killer was white and the dead people were black. They were in their church. But, you know, a lot of African-Americans are people of very strong Christian faith. And I think this is a testament to the black church and their involved in the black church.
What do you think of the judge?
Well, the judge, I don't think she should have done it. But just to finish for a second, but you get away from the religious angle. I mean, if you just look at psychology in general, not forgiving does a lot more damage to the person wronged. Holding a grudge and being angry.
Yeah, that's intellectually very satisfying. Emotionally, I have to say, the notion that I could ever do in a lifetime what this young man, this brother, did yesterday. By the way, I wish I could. I'm not in any way being dismissive of it.
Yeah.
I have such admiration for his strength.
Yeah.
I can't for the smallest slights, as well, you know.
We know that, Jim.
But I'm serious.
This is not kind of in your wheelhouse.
Let me just say, I totally subscribe to the notion, because you and I have done a huge numbers, a number of shows about forgiveness through the years here. And I am totally on board with wanting to be like this young man, or mm-hmm. wanting to be the kind of person who doesn't get owned by the bitterness that I often feel But it's one thing to say it, and it's another thing to be able to do it. And mm-hmm. And that's what we want to know. Again, if you want to respond to the Geiger thing, it's fine. We want to know in your life, have you been able to, would you like to be able to forgive people for things that cut pretty deep in your life?
We should just say before we take the calls that forgiving is not excusing or condoning.
That's right.
It's a whole different thing. It's allowing you to not be bound up by the anger and the resentment and the need for revenge and holding a grudge, which will essentially poison you and not poison the person you're holding the grudge or resentment against. So,
by the way,
Jim, it's something to think about and consider.
I actually think about it all the time.
You were first in your bar mitzvah class.
I was.
Maybe it's time to go back and read some of those prayers you
I was first in my bar mitzvah class because I read Hebrew faster than their bells. It had nothing to do with my attitudes about life. By the way, totally coincidentally, if people care about this topic, which I hope they do, I have the former dean of Harvard Law School, Martha Minow, who's written a book, What Should Law Forgive?, about law and forgiveness, you know, from South Africa to the United States and everything in between. So, again, if you care about this, well, I'm going to continue it tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston. Let's start in Worcester with Paul. You're on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for the call.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent.
Fine, thank you.
I have a quote before my opinion, and this kind of reiterates what Marjorie just said. Anger is a poison we drink in hopes that others will die.
That's a great quote.
Who said that, by the way?
It's something I heard years ago, and I just hung on to it. I have another one at the end of my opinion, too. But,
okay.
To me, it's all about moving forward. It's not, you're not giving someone a pass. You're not forgetting. You're not trusting that person again. You're not going to, you know, put yourself in that position again. It's letting go of your negative attitudes, rather than holding on too tightly to that cup of acid while it eats through your hands.
Okay, so before
exactly
you give us
what Marjorie said.
Before you give a second quote, few people listening to the show today have experienced something as horrible as this young man, the brother of the victim, did yesterday. But pick something relatively horrible that's happened in your life. Could you both forgive, and you've obviously thought about it a lot, and then walk over and hug the person who had done you or someone you love wrong, like this young man did yesterday?
Not for a second.
Well, you're an honest guy. Okay.
And that's what I mean about, it's not about, I think when for me, if I did that, I would be putting myself in a position where I would have to trust them, and they've already shown me that they can't be trusted.
That's great.
But I could let go of my anger towards them.
What's your other quote before you go, Paul?
Actually, I said it, but it's anger is a cup of acid we hold on to tightly while it eats through your hands.
Oh, jeez. Well, you've thought about this. Paul, thanks for a great call. We appreciate it. 877-301-8970. Could you do this? Have you done this?
Well, thank goodness I have not experienced
anything like a
family member getting murdered.
I understand that. But you've had slights, I know.
Have
you forgiven people? And are you conscious in the forgiving, if you do, about what you've said and what Paul said, about how it's really more about freeing yourself?
Yeah.
You really? And you can
Haven't you gone to therapy for 40 years?
No, not directly. not without breaks. No.
I think this is something you should talk about with your
But you're acting as
therapist.
Paul was such an honest guy. He espoused, he reiterated
because
the exact same things you did and said he couldn't do it. I'm exactly where he is.
I think people who've had very bad situations or trauma or everyday things like divorce, you have to decide whether you're going to be angry for the rest of your life or whether, as Paul said, you are going to move on and you're going to realize that this hatred and anger is just hurting you. It's not hurting the other person.
I know this is a long time ago. Remember Bud Welch?
Yes.
Bud Welch's daughter was killed in Oklahoma City.
Yep, in the
bombing. We interviewed him and developed a bit of a relationship. You wrote about him. He was on the TV show with us on New England Cable News many years ago. What was that about? Do you remember? Was that forgiveness?
Well, Bud Welch became a terrible alcoholic after his daughter died, mm-hmm. and he was unable to work and unable to function. And then he decided that that was not the way he was going to live the rest of his life. And he befriended one of your buddies, a firefighter from Cambridge, whose son, Jeffrey Curley, Bob Curley was the dad.
Who was the fire, Jeffrey, worked for the fire department, yeah.
Jeffrey Curley was the son, and people may remember he was, I think, 10 or 11 years old. He was abducted, sexually abused, and murdered by these two horrible pedophiles. And Bob Curley had become kind of the poster boy for politicians wanting to get the death penalty passed in Massachusetts.
When Governor Slucci was in the chair.
Shortly after he met Bud Welch.
On our show.
Bob Curley, for whom I have enormous respect and admiration, did a 180, too, and decided that wasn't the way he wants to live his life. So some people spend their lives plotting revenge.
For the smallest slights. And others forgive. You know, and in fairness to both Curley and Welch, I don't know about forgiveness. They both... Welch became a huge national advocate against death penalty, and then Bob ultimately did switched. And you actually wrote the column that about his switch. So I don't know if forgiveness was part of that or whatever it was. They just became anti-death penalty. But again, I wish I was that kind of. I really wish I was that kind of person, but it's nowhere near to being in my genes. Bernier, you're in Hyde Park. You're on Boston Public Radio. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, guys. And Marjorie, I hope you feel better.
Thank you.
I turned on my computer and I was looking at Facebook yesterday. When I saw this, I was literally sick to my stomach.
Wait, when you say this, you mean the brother or the judge or both?
No. When I saw the verdict, when I saw that this woman only received 10 years, I mean, what? As a black person, let me tell you, it's just crazy that we are always asked to be the one that who forgive. We have a perversion of Christianity. Well, not a perversion. We have a perverted religion called Christianity that's been given to us. I don't know if you guys know that the slaves were handed part of the Bible that were not... I don't know if you read that, Marjorie. That there's that
Marjorie. Yeah, listen, it goes right to Marjorie.
Yeah, sort of slanted Bible to justify slavery.
Exactly. So there is this thing in Black Christianity that we have to forgive forever. I mean, Mandela with his Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Everybody, anything that happens to the Black community, we have to forgive. Yet the evangelicals, who they don't forgive anything about Blacks, nothing. Whenever we even mention affirmative action or slavery, we just have to walk it off. It just upsets me so much that this woman is only getting 10 years. And if the table were turned, you have this white woman who's working for Price, who has a job at Price Waterhouse. And who's sitting at home in her 90 drinking ice cream, and some black cop who just was sexting with his whatever girlfriend got in there by mistake. A cop is supposed to be very vigilant. You have to know where you have to be lucid. She was not high, and you shoot somebody, and you only get 10 years. You're eligible for parole in less than 5 years. That's just ridiculous.
By the way, again, if people just tuned in, the law for murder in Texas says that a judge can sentence someone from 5 to 99 years. Yeah. And by the way, she could have been convicted of manslaughter. Obviously, the jury decided that it should be the ultimate crime, which I guess lends some ammunition, so to speak, to your position.
But Bernier, I get what you're saying, because that's the same argument Irene Monroe makes, that why are black people always expected to be forgiving all the atrocities hoisted upon them by white people or anybody else. But on the other hand, I also see it as an extremely admirable and the standard that the rest of us should be living up to, that black Americans who have been so smart about voting and so able to rise above so much baloney and then to show this incredible act of forgiveness. To me, they're setting a kind of standard.
But I think Bernier's point is there's not the same expectation of white people.
Well, there's not the reciprocity at all. I mean, white evangelicals, we all know, are disgracing themselves. But you know, Tina, you live in Hyde Park, Bernier. Tina Charity doesn't live in Hyde Park. I think she lives in Dorchester. But you probably have heard about her. Her son was killed at 15 years old. Lewis Brown. She started the Peace and Reconciliation Foundation in Dorchester, and she is like a radiant person. And she not only went to visit her son's killer in jail, but employs the killer's mother at her office. And I mean, when you see her, it's just like you can feel this something coming out of her that's so inspiring. So I think women like her are setting a standard.
I agree with you. I actually was on the board of the Louis D. Brown
Peace Institute.
Well, then you know better than I.
Peace Institute. I know, but the point is, when I was on the board, we were still looking for justice to be done for Louis. What I'm saying is that justice has not been done within 10 years. If the woman had at least 25 to life, okay, this kid could hug her till Jesus comes. I wouldn't mind. It's the 10 years that bothers me.
Okay.
Brittany, a great call as always. Thanks so much for your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Well, that's a good point. 10 years is not very much. Although, frankly, with the way things have been going with police officers and young black men.
Well, there are no convictions to begin with.
I was kind of surprised. You know, I was afraid she was going to get involuntary manslaughter, or she was going to.
Well, you know, on that note, even though that isn't our topic right now, I'm really thrilled that Andrew Cabral is coming in at noon, because many people are reading much more into this verdict than I do, meaning they're reading into it. Maybe the table's about to turn. Maybe cops will be held accountable for shooting unarmed and killing unarmed black people. I'm not so sure this goes beyond the facts of this case and that jury and that setting, but we'll see what Andrew has to say.
Well, one of the points made in many of the stories is that there was an incredible legal team here.
And a diverse jury pool here.
Exactly. And so you wonder how much of that factored into what happened. Anyway, we're talking about the role of forgiveness. We're talking about Jim's issues with forgiveness, asking if you could do what Branshaw has done. The conversation continues on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the role of forgiveness, asking if you could do what Branshaw has done. He is the brother of the man who was killed by Amber Guyger. As you just heard, Amber Guyger was sentenced by the judge to 10 years, could have been five, anywhere from 5 to 99. And in addition to his brother, who news reports suggest has been hit hardest by the murder of his brother, not only forgave the killer in his victim impact statement, but then turns to the judge and asks her if it's permissible, if it's okay for him to step down and go hug the killer. She said yes, she the judge. He gets off the chair there and walks down, and he's met halfway by Amber Guyger, and they embrace for what seems like an eternity. And everybody so far who's given us a call or an email has spoken about that, which is fine, but we were hoping we could also talk about sort of the broader notion about whether or not you have it in you to forgive, and do you subscribe to the notion that Marjorie and others are talking about, that forgiveness is more about helping yourself than it is the person who is receiving the forgiveness. Valerie in Cambridge, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hello.
Hi.
So I called about... I agree with Marjorie. Forgiveness is very much for oneself. I had an abusive childhood, and in my 40s managed to forgive my parents, and that was really for me. And it's also something that is not a one-time thing. I have to keep forgiving every time denial is part of the conversation. And as far as trust goes, if I had to trust them before I forgave them, it never would have happened.
So their response to your forgiveness was not even relevant. What mattered was what you were doing for you, Valerie.
Absolutely. Completely irrelevant. I mean, they reap the benefits, but
and do you not worry about that? I mean, Marjorie is making fun of me, but it's no, but it's true. We had a former employer who did a horrible thing to us.
Oh my God.
And it wasn't 1/100th as bad as what you're describing, or obviously what happened to the Jean family.
And you had plans that would have got us both arrested.
Maybe so. I'll never forgive it. And by the way, it's not because I don't know that it would help me to let it loose. It's because I don't want to give him anything that'll make him feel better after his bad behavior. So how do you get around that, Valerie?
It doesn't have, ultimately I came to a place where it didn't have anything to do with them. It was completely, well, selfish might be not quite the right word, but
it is either.
It is completely selfish to not live with that sort of angst. It's like you took my childhood, but you're not going to take the serenity of my adult years.
Well, you're amazing.
I think that's fantastic, that's Valerie. Really, and you know what I think is also fantastic? The point you made about having to often do it over and over and over again. It's not like a, okay, on Wednesday, I've forgiven and I'm done. You know, you'd probably do it again Saturday and the following Wednesday. That's important too, I think. Don't you know what I mean?
Critical.
Yeah. Valerie, really glad you called. Really glad you called. Thanks so much for sharing your experience. 877-301-8970.
Eric from Lawrence, thank you for calling.
Hey, Eric.
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Good.
Yeah, I think that his brother was a silly boy, and now as a black man, I have to, every time I hear something at my door, I think the police officer coming to shoot me. I already have to be worried about getting pulled over between Boston and Lawrence. Now I can't even have serenity in my house because my killer would get 5 years, and then my baby brother will hug his killer. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous.
But Eric, I totally understand your perspective, but you've heard everybody else talk about it wasn't for Amber Geiger. Well, we don't know what was in Brant Jean's mind, but it was more for Brant Jean, arguably.
Well, he's selfish. He's selfish. I can't forgive this. I mean, she had racist tweets.
Yeah, that's
true. She went into an apartment that clearly was not hers. She's a police officer. Let's not be naive here. He's selfish. He wants to feel better. And do whatever he has to do to miss his brother. That's his killer. He was eating ice cream at home after work.
He was.
Now we don't even have to. He can't forgive her because I don't give him permission to forgive her for me.
Well, you know, it's an interesting point you raised, too, about what this means in your life. But you've also recognized what it might have meant in this brother's life. You said it was selfish. I don't know if I'd call him selfish, but that he was trying to feel better. You're right, Eric, but I don't begrudge him trying to feel better. You know what I mean?
With this forgiving, one of my best friends went to the church in Charleston where that boy went in and shot up a prayer meeting, a Bible class. You're not forgiven. Enough with this. It's a myth. They can find one or two black people that will hug and forgive these people. The vast majority of us do not forgive you for 400 years of this.
By the way, you know, I'm sure you know, in that situation, that there, we had the judge in that case, Judge Gergel, who had written a book about the civil rights struggle in another fashion. He wouldn't talk about the case. He was with us a couple of months ago.
The Dylan Roof case.
But Dylan Roof. But you know that in that, obviously you do, Eric, that in that same courtroom, there were mothers who turned to Dylan Roof and said they forgave him as well. Do you feel the same way about them as you do about Jean's
brother? One of my best friends attends that church, and South Carolina is a carry state. He carries his pistol with him to church now.
Wow.
Carries it with him to church. So this is a myth. You get one or two black people that want to hug and sing kumbaya with these people enough. It's a myth.
Eric, thanks for the call. We appreciate it.
You.
We really do. 877-301-8970. I don't want to sound like a moron, but I want to say I understand that too. I mean, this is one of these situations where almost every call can move me in the direction of the caller's Kohler's argument. I definitely feel that way, by the way, and I know it's a difference. I think the judge thing, which, again, we'll discuss with Andy, is so totally
over the top.
Yeah. And so I don't know how the family of the victim feel, but talk about disrespectful. The woman was just convicted of murder. And what is
10
it?
10 years.
Yeah. And as a lot of people have said in those, in some of the pieces critical of her, is, you know, who, what other defendants in what kinds of settings, particularly people of color, after being convicted of something, where did the judge walk off his or her bench and go down to hug the defendant post-conviction and sentencing?
I would say, I've just taken a quick look at the email. I think it's fair to say we have a very unforgiving crowd.
What are they
emailing.
Saying? What are they saying?
Well, Arturo said that he cannot imagine a white family forgiving a black murderer in this way. And he thought the judge giving the Bible to him.
Her.
Her.
Geiger,
he didn't think that was a bad thing. But
didn't think it was a bad thing.
No, but I think that's one of the arguments that's made all the time among African-Americans, that why do they always have to be the ones forgiving? Where's the reciprocation?
By the way, there is a point. Can you think? I'm sure neither of us are historians of the judicial process. Can you think of a white person who whose family was victimized or they were victimized who forgave the perpetrator?
I'm
the convicted
thinking,
perpetrator.
I have not come up with anyone.
877-301-8970. Nick and Brighton, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling. Hi.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
I was going to say that for me, this sort of thing is more circumstantial. Speaking as a white non-Christian, I can't really know where either side in this particular story is coming from. But I feel like, at least for me, I can't really forgive someone unless they seem to actually be truly remorseful for something. Otherwise, it seems like I'm letting that, and if I do actually forgive them, I wouldn't let them know if they weren't remorseful, because it would seem to be letting them off the hook.
Letting like off the hook thing is a big deal for me too there, Nick.
But in the case of this, if the person, that's really up to them to forgive, if they truly feel like, in my opinion, if the person is truly remorseful and is truly changed and wants to keep changing, then, like I said, I'm not a Christian, but that's pretty darn Christ-like in its own way. Like, that's the hard work that most people don't want to do.
Pretty darn Christ-like.
Move on.
Nick, thank you. By the way, I want to correct one of my coworkers has corrected me. I keep saying the judge sentenced Geiger to 10 years. The jury was responsible for the sentencing in Dallas, not the judge. My apologies for the wrong information.
Let's go to Ann in Needham. Hi, Ann.
Hello, Ann.
Hey there. Can you hear me?
We can.
Yes.
Okay, I'm on a remote phone, so I don't know how this works.
We're fine.
Even though I understand the man's flaws and I understand where he came from, he molested my child, and he's now dead, John Gagan.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, the priest.
And I cannot forgive him. And it's not eating me up. I've done the healing. I've left the church. So I've done what I need to do to save myself, and my son has done what he needs to do to save himself, thank God. He's one of the few who actually has survived well. But he spent 15 years keeping it to himself and having a miserable life, but he has turned it all around now. All that's fine, but I will never forgive John Gagan.
So, Anne, you said you've done what you needed to do, and your son has too, and congratulations on that. But how did you come to terms with this nightmare?
I don't know if I have ever come to terms with it. We've done the work, both of us, his entire family, for that matter. We've done what we need to do to move on and make our lives successful in our own ways.
But what did that mean, though? What does doing the work mean?
Well, I joined Voice of the Faithful, and I gave talks all over New England about what happened.
Yep.
So I've vented, and I've made it very clear, and I've told everyone so that they can be aware and be cognizant of what the possibilities are.
I have to say I'm with Anne.
And one last thing.
Oh, I'm sorry.
One last thing. And did your son go through therapy, or how did he turn his life around?
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. He was arrested because he was drunk and caused a great deal of harm. Nobody was killed, thank goodness. But I was able to send him to Hazelden, insist that he go, and he was lucky. He never has relapsed. He's been sober for 22 years.
That's truly great.
Thank you. That
and
was a
really
great call.
Your
and
calling.
Thank you very much.
All these calls.
Well, she's
calls.
Obviously showing another way to get through it without that forgiveness, because she has, and so has her son. So apparently, for many people, it's not the only way. It's one way, not the only way. Mary in Weymouth, thank you for calling.
That's amazing. Hi, Mary.
Hi there. I have a cousin that was a victim of random violence that was murdered back, I think, in 75. And talking to my aunt, who was just, you know, your typical middle-class Irish mother. He was the oldest of eight.
California.
She had said to me she was glad that no one was ever arrested because she didn't have a person to hate. And I'm still moved by that, you know, years later. And the other thing I also wanted to bring up was the shooting at the Amish schoolhouse.
Oh, yes, sure. Where those children were killed.
Yeah. Yes, and they immediately offered forgiveness. And I remember hearing one of them that was interviewed, and he said he offered forgiveness first, and then he had to walk it every day.
Yeah.
And they have reached out. They take care of the children of that shooter. They have helped with education for them. And the mother of that shooter is a caretaker for one of the children that was left paralyzed.
Wow.
And, that is
but what really struck me with that was I forgave first, and I have to walk it every day.
Mary, that was another great one. Thank you very much for the call. I have to say, these are about as good a set of calls on an important issue as any I can remember. Really stunning.
Do we have time for any more? Are we out of time?
Unfortunately, we don't.
Oh, we're out of time. Okay.
It is amazing. She was glad she didn't have someone to hate. I mean, I can totally relate to that.
Well, you know, there's a great book, Dead Man Walking, written by this nun, actually, who did a lot of investigative work on people on death row. And she looked at people whose loved ones had been murdered, who were big death penalty advocates, and what it did to their lives versus those mm-hmm. who came to terms. And it's interesting. It's not expansive. It's not everybody, but it was a really interesting book about, I think, forgiveness in the criminal justice system. Dead Man Walking. What's the nun's name? I forget.
I'm trying to think of it. And I can't. It's funny you say that. I'm thinking.
Anyway, there was a movie too. Susan Sarandon played her in the movie.
We're gonna we're gonna sort of take a slightly different angle here. We're gonna continue to discuss this with Andrew Cabral in just a couple of seconds, meaning the Geiger case and the forgiveness and the judge's behavior and all that sort of
stuff. That's right. Andrew Cabral is up next with her edition of Law and Order. We're gonna talk to Andrew Cabral, former sheriff of Suffolk County, next on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Ahead on Boston Public Radio, Black Jurors Matter. Amber Geiger, who killed a black man in his own home, has become one of the rare police officers to be convicted of murder, despite a system that often works in their favor. Does this verdict have something to do with the fact that the jury pool was diverse? Andrew Cabral joins us for this and more on today's edition of Law & Order. And what does inclusion look like for people with disabilities? That's the subject of the documentary Intelligent Lives. We'll talk to its executive producers, husband and wife, and actors, Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper.
How long will race be viewed as a factor in admissions? A decision favoring Harvard upholds affirmative action, but for how long? We'll talk to former Secretary of Education Paul Revel about this and other headlines. Then Harvard historian Nancy Kane is here to talk about what lessons FDR's New Deal has for today's Green New Deal. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio. I apologize for my voice. I hope to be better tomorrow. This is hour number two. Hello again, Jim.
Hello again, Marjorie. Here with us in Studio 3 for another edition of Law & Order is former Suffolk County Sheriff, former Secretary of Public Safety, Andrew Cabral. Andrea, as you know, is the CEO of Ascend. Hello, Andrea Cabral.
Hello, Jim. Hello, Marjorie.
So, Andrew Cabral, I want to ask you about the conversation we just had with listeners about the brother of the dead Mr. John, Botham John, down in... Dallas being the brother going over and hugging the cop, the Amber Geiger, who shot his brother while his brother was sitting on his couch eating ice cream, minding his own business in his apartment at the age of 26 or 27.
Right. So I did get here. I actually got here early today, and I was actually listening to the last half hour of the show, so I heard the last half hour of calls.
You can listen to us on the car radio as you drive over here, too. I just want to point that out.
It's an app, too.
That's very true, and I always have music on, and then I get here and I go, oh, I probably should have been listening to the show. And that happens every single week.
Thank you for your support.
That's why I donate. My view on the brother is, people, I agree with what many of the callers said. People do what they need to do, what suits them in terms of their own spirituality and their own healing. And I don't take issue with him hugging her. He felt that that was what he should do. It seemed to be based on his religious beliefs or his spiritual beliefs, and he was acting in accordance with them. I would never, ever, ever begrudge a victim any expression of that nature. They are the most harmed. Nobody will ever know exactly how they feel, and they are entitled. If to nothing else in the criminal justice system where the focus is on the defendant, they are certainly entitled in terms of the statement they give before the court to express themselves the way they want to express them. The judge's hug is a very different thing. The judge had actually, when she read the verdict, if you watch the tape, there was a reaction of gratitude, I guess, from the family. There was it wasn't exactly like a yell or a scream, but there was something audible. And she actually admonished the family. She said, no outbursts, no outbursts. And then she left the bench to hug a defendant. I have never, in 16 years of being a prosecutor, never seen a judge hug a criminal defendant upon conviction. Never seen a judge hug a victim or a defendant. They are the arbiters of the law, and they facilitate the delivery of facts based on evidence to a jury. They are supposed to be as dispassionate as they can be and as impartial as they can be. Now, I understand that, she may have felt, the judge clearly felt in that moment, and everyone who was in that courtroom agreed that what Eric Jean's brother did was a stunning moment in the courtroom. But we pay judges to rise above
both
that.
Both of them, Sean. Eric was the caller. You said Eric.
Oh, I'm sorry. Fine. Both of them, John's. I'm thinking about Eric's comments
caller,
on the call. Yeah.
The guy from
both of them, John's brother. And, we pay judges to be the referees in the courtroom, among other things. So I did think that the judge hugging her was inappropriate and quite frankly, at least in my experience, unprecedented.
Can we talk human beings here? I'm guessing, I know you a little bit for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing there, you and I may have a similar approach to life when it comes. I'm not proud of it. I'm not bragging about it, but I would bet you're not a terribly forgiving soul. Is that a fair?
Yeah, the dirty secret is that Jim and I are actually a lot more alike than most people would think from our conversations here. No, that's true. I don't, but I have a more dispassionate view. I don't think that declining to forgive someone by definition means that you give that person energy.
Or
power over you. I think that, I agree. You had a caller, one of the last two callers talked about, not forgiving someone who was not remorseful,
mm-hmm.
Or hasn't shown that they're deserving of it. Yeah, I don't think that there are people that don't deserve to be forgiven. There are people that don't ask for forgiveness. I'm not one of those people who forgives because I think it will help me, because I don't give energy to those that I haven't forgiven. I'm not, with one notable exception that we've discussed recently, I don't spend time plotting revenge against people who have, with one notable exception.
You know who you are out there.
Yeah. And if he doesn't, he should. I just don't do that as a general rule, but I don't feel compelled to forgive. And I don't feel as though I am harmed by the failure to forgive.
You know, there's a piece in the Washington Post we touched on just briefly. And let me just read you a quote that sort of encapsulates the argument here. This guy is Jamar Tisby is his name. He's an African-American historian. I think, it's a quote, I think black people are legitimately upset when we extend grace in the face of clear and blatant injustices, but we're never extended that same grace in the public mind.
Right, right. So, and to Eric's point, right, so this is a really, there's a lot to unpack in this. So Eric was making the point that, you know, he thought it was selfish for Botham Jean's brother to forgive Geiger. And he said, I don't allow you to forgive on my behalf. And when I heard him say that, what I heard was the point I've made many, many times on this show is that one of the effects of systemic institutional racism is that you don't have the luxury of acting as an individual. What you do on behalf of the whole race because you are lumped into a category that, say, white males are never lumped into. So if there's a white male, white supremacist shooter, everyone talks about his individual problems and his, you know, his possible mental health. And it's focused on him as an individual, despite the fact that there are a massive number of shooters by white males of a certain age. If a Muslim does it, it's about the Muslim religion and we need to ban them from a country. And that is an absolute outgrowth of systemic institutional racism, is that you always have the luxury, if you are in the default race, of lumping other people together and holding an entire group of people responsible for the actions of an individual. So that's what I think Eric was talking about. That said, I am always moved and on some level, proud is a weird word, but on some level proud of the incessant humanity that black people show in this country in the face of the most unrelenting oppression. And if there is proof of a soul in a human being, that to me is it. And on the third hand,
me too though. I think it's so impressive and uplifting.
It is, but the anger that people feel is that it's great to admire it. But there isn't reciprocity.
There isn't reciprocity.
And quite frankly, it has been used in a sort of systemic and malicious way to keep the message to black people that they need to be forgiven all the time. Because you see it enshrined in TV and film and in books every place else. I mean, you see it. You see it in movies like The Green Mile. You see it in movies like Green Book. You see it. There was a movie with Taraji P. Henson and Sam Rockwell. It was just insane about this incredibly racist cop, but somehow he becomes friends with a black woman. And because in much the same way as one of your earlier callers talked about giving a redacted version of the Bible to slaves,
yeah,
so that they would only learn the parts that caused them to absorb with immense grace the absolute atrocity that is slavery, that has been a consistent message. It has been, you know, the idea of happy slaves is right in that category. So that's where the anger comes from black people. And there's also anger at the idea that people like me are sitting and explaining this in 2019, and it is not automatically understood. So, like I said, there's a lot to unpack. And I think that the lessons of grace and poise and forgiveness are wonderful, but they are so much more useless when the people who are consistently needing to be forgiven don't learn from them. That's a problem.
Now, before you continue, I want to say, while we aren't taking calls right now, some person who actually works in the building by the name of Callie Crossley just called the control room to say, amen, Andrea. I want you to know.
But, Callie, how are you?
But let me ask you a question, because there's so much institutional racism and so much individual racism, and there's just so much constant racism. When I try to put myself in the shoes of someone who's black, obviously I'm not, I think there's so, on a daily basis, there's so many racist mini aggressions, whatever you call them, that if you didn't manage to slough some of these things off, I don't know if you forgive them or what, that you'd be in a constant rage because it's constantly there. You know, I can't imagine what that's like in life, you know, whether it's just going in and having somebody think you're going to steal from the 7-Eleven or whatever it is. You know what I mean? So that there's...
Right. I mean, I think that that's true. And what in one of the greatest ironies that we faced over the years, but particularly in 2019, you know, the notion that economic anxiety causes racism, that an irrational fear of people of color or Muslims or any other group causes racism, that the calling out of racism, the objection to racism. You'll go on Twitter and you find people saying, well, I wasn't going to be racist until you called me one, and now I'm going to be one. If that were actually a naturally occurring phenomenon and not an applied one that people who are racist anyway want to use as an excuse, black people would be Nazis. They would be black supremacists. They would be in a rage, as you say, every single day, and have taken up arms a long time ago. And here's the thing. Part of the reason that people like me sit on shows like this and continue to talk about this and continue to explain it is because white people who do on some level understand this fail to confront other white people who are the perpetrators of it. It is not going to happen if the only people talking about the effect of systemic racism and oppression are the people who are systemically oppressed. That is, everyone knows that. But those conversations are rarely had. It's almost as though white people who do understand on some level what other people face are find it difficult to they would rather think of whites who are racist or, you know, people who are whatever group you're talking about, homophobia, whatever it is, prefer to think of them as a discrete group. They are the other. They just don't get it. I would never be like that. I would never say those things. These people don't get it. And you think of them as a part. But that goes to my earlier point. You are allowing them to fail as human beings, as individuals, in a society that does not allow people who are not white, and particularly who are not white male, to fail as individuals. So treat them as a group, go after them as a group, and confront them as a group about what they are doing to the people that you know, that you care about, or just based on the fact that you virulently disagree with the fact that, and you know, look at what's being perpetrated from the very top in this country today. That is a result of a failure of white people to confront other white people when they do stuff like that.
Well, why don't we move on?
Voice of Andrew Cabral, by the way.
Why don't we move on to, because I did want to ask you about your favorite politician. That would be the President of the United States. And you are a former politician. Do you have any particular insights or thoughts on this impeachment effort and whether there will be some joining if the House does vote? Impeachment.
Just before I left, he was out on the White House lawn, and I had actually just tweeted before I left to the press pool, stop interviewing him on the White House lawn where we can't hear any of the questions that you're asking because he does it on purpose because Air Force One is in the background and there's a ton of noise, and he controls the narrative. Force him to give formal press briefings. If he doesn't have a press secretary, he'd have to do them himself or he'd have to go without coverage. Just before I left here, he stood out on the White House lawn and openly, he's leaning into this now because he's been caught and he can't deny it anymore, openly said China should be investigating the Bidens as well. And he would again encourage President Zelensky of Ukraine to go after the Bidens. The fact that we could have started this impeachment process and could have educated people to the point where they are educated now a year ago, and probably or possibly could have prevented a lot of this, infuriates me that he was allowed to go on hurting this country, hurting the people in it, killing the environment, denying science, every other thing that he has done. And he now stands on the White House lawn, as I said today, talking about the completely baseless, false claims against the Bidens when he and his family I've been engaged in one of the most rank and longstanding criminal enterprises this country has ever seen, certainly never by the family of a president, is astonishing to me. And while I'm glad that it's going forward right now and I think it will ultimately end in impeachment.
You do?
I do think it will.
Republicans?
No, impeachment, she said, not conviction.
Well, I think it's at this point. There's a. I mean, what he did today, I don't even know why I'm laughing. I think I'm laughing because of the absurdity of this. He stood on the White House lawn and openly solicited and encouraged foreign nations. Yeah. He created a national security crisis in broad daylight on the steps, on the White House
Fine
lawn.
Point, actually.
Right?
Yeah.
If you are a Republican senator and you don't think that's impeachable, you have no business being anywhere near politics, representing anyone in this country. It's just insane. What he did today was insane. But what he's learned is that if he leans into the insanity, people will accept it more than if he continues to deny it. He finally learned that lesson.
Can we pick up on something you said a minute ago at the end of the discussion about the Geiger situation? You were saying it's up to white people to confront white racists.
Mm-hmm.
We discuss a lot why virtually no one within Republican ranks, whether they're senators, staff people, other than an anonymous whistleblower or a member of the House or Senate who resigns and then speaks out against Trump, why do so few people of his own party, if practically none, stand up and confront Donald Trump? What's the answer to the question, do you think?
Oh, because cowardice is one of the main features of politics.
But fear of what? I mean, I hate to keep picking the same example, and people think I'm picking on Romney. The only reason I keep picking on Romney is because he is older and has five more years in his Senate term. And I don't think he's dying to run again for the Senate at 82 or whatever he's going to be.
He's a big Mormon.
So, but I mean more the generic Mitt Romney than, you know, he's not running for re-election in a year like every member of the House of Representatives. I'm not defending them, but, you know, they worry a tweet's going to cost them their job. What did Jeff Flake say, though? Another retired.
He said you can always get another job. You can't get another soul.
So,
would that he had stood up a little bit more and stood in the way of some votes when he was in the Senate.
I agree with that. But as I said to someone, I think I said this morning, maybe I said it to Marjorie, Chuck Todd. I understand why a majority aren't doing it. I'm not excusing it. I'm just commenting on it. I don't understand why they're not outliers here and there. One member of a staff. Remember Gary Cohn, supposedly after Charlottesville, mm-hmm. said that he was going to resign over the grotesque racism.
Yeah.
And of course, he resigned over some business thing over, tariffs or trade or something. I think it was maybe a South Korean trade deal or some such thing later. Well, he says, maybe in his own defense or to blow his reputation up in a positive way, that I was ready to quit over my boss's racism. Why is nobody willing to quit over anything that you, on your bill of particulars, just listed against the President of the United States?
Well, I do think that actually cowardice is a feature and not a glitch in politics. And this goes to the earlier conversation that we were having. I think maybe one of the answers that needs to be confronted here is that at the end of the day, though they may not like how he expresses it, and they may not like that they have to answer for what he says, Donald Trump does represent the interests of the predominantly white male GOP Senate. Isn't that the only thing you're left with? At the end of the day, if I cannot stand up for my country, and part of it may be because I'm afraid, right? But in the case of the individuals that you cited who have virtually nothing to lose, you still don't do it. What answer is left other than I would never admit it to myself? But I kind of like the privilege I live with. I kind of like being a rich white guy in the United States of America. And my taxes were lower last year. You know what?
Yeah, but I guess I'd say in response to that, I don't want the woman I love or my daughter or somebody else molested by a billionaire on an airplane or in a dressing room. And, you know, there are things that I believe, there are a lot of Republicans who have been silent, shamefully silent, mm-hmm. I would argue, on moral issues relating to the president. Forget policy issues, who may love his policy, but it seems to me on the moral issues, like one I just mentioned, maybe I'm incredibly naive. I guess I am, because the facts belie my position. I just can't believe that there's some guy who doesn't wake up in the morning and say, I can't do this anymore. I can't.
Well,
I
that's why they're not running.
Be a party to the. Yeah. Maybe that is the answer.
Yeah,
is they those, retire
that's
rather
the cowardice
than they retire.
Part is the right. Cowardice part is not challenging him in real time when you are charged with representing people from your district and the country, quite frankly. But the ones that have said we won't run again, that's what I think the best you're ever going to get out of them is the ones that
but
won't run again.
But here's what I wonder is why a group of these people that have left. The guy from Tennessee that left, or people maybe in the State Department, or this group of people doesn't get together en masse and say, this guy's got to go.
How about all the living presidents en masse? Why isn't that happening?
Because I think they'd be discounted because you can't have Obama. Well,
George Bush is not a Democrat. I mean, they know he doesn't like him, he doesn't like him, I would argue, for pretty good reasons.
I've had the same answer, and that's the reason I gave the answer I gave is because the only answer I can come up with is that there's a level of agreement with him, that he is doing in a very dirty way the very dirty work that people who won't even admit it to themselves want him to do. And I base that on the history of the country, and I base that on the absence, despite thinking about it for a long period of time, of any other plausible answer.
Well, that's a very bleak answer, isn't it?
I know, but that's why you bring me on the show, is to act,
Marjorie,
as a depressant for your entire audience.
So since we have concluded in the last hour's discussion with Andrea and callers before that you're different from Andrea and me, you're a more forgiving soul because
you do want to free yourself.
Why don't you forgive Donald Trump for his sins so that it? Because you are to say that you are completely a captive of your antipathy. Tell me if I'm overstating this, your antipathy towards the President of the United States is a fair statement.
Well,
is it not?
I guess I would say I can forgive him, I hope, when he is not currently
power.
In office taking down the country I love. You know,
I will never forgive him.
Okay. Well,
no, I term it as a malignant narcissist, but he's doing deeply evil.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know what? You know, No. There is something deeply evil in that man. If you look up, I wish everybody would just look up the definition of malignant narcissism.
Oh, he fits it.
Because
completely.
Sadism is a feature of it as well. But he's also, here's the reason to not forgive him. Unless you're spending every single day figuring out how to, you know, get revenge by force remove him from office. He doesn't need your forgiveness, and he's not asking for it. Keep that in mind.
Yeah.
He does not believe that he's done anything for which he should be forgiven.
What surprises me, I guess, is not the zillionaires and the people in Congress. It surprises me, regular Joe and Janes, particularly some of the people that call us and listen to us. The only thing I can figure out is that maybe they're wrapped up in this fog of the Trump media or something. Because you say at this point, Why would you support him unless you really hate him?
Marjorie, did you hear the poll? I said it yesterday. 29% of Republicans said in a Monmouth poll that, quote, the president probably did not mention Biden in his call with the president of Ukraine when the president of the United States admits he mentioned Biden.
It's not just
admitted.
We
call
played
with the president
people
of Ukraine.
Who took the notes of the call.
Exactly.
We played
right.
the sound about 10 times.
Right.
Should we play it once more?
No,
well,
we
there's
shouldn't.
A persistent, there's a
he
willful ignorance.
Himself.
And you know, people always answer questions from the position of how much they know about a particular topic. And if you are, if you're watching only a particular kind of news and you're not, you know, really looking to educate yourself and you don't want anybody to invalidate what you believe anyway, there's no reason for you to become educated on this stuff. I'm just not one to make excuses. I'm not an economic anxiety or any other excuse kind of a person for any of this stuff. I have a very clear view of why all of this is what's led up to this and why it's happening right now.
So since you asked, Andrew Cabral, and we are here for you, Kernberg, whoever he is or she is, described malignant narcissism as a syndrome characterized by a narcissistic personality disorder, antisocial features, you can stop me at any point.
Got there.
Paranoid traits.
Check.
And egosyntonic,
big
I'm
time.
Sorry, I don't know what that means, aggression. Other symptoms, I'm not done, Marjorie, may include an absence of conscience.
Check.
A psychological need for power.
Absolutely.
And a sense of grandiosity.
Well, can we say more?
Andrea rests her case.
No, it's just absolutely true. So people who are still waiting for him to behave like a president or talk, even those that are pundits that sit on TV and when people are discussing things that he says is the president, they are still couching them in the context of someone who is elected to lead all of the people. And what amazes me about that is that you are dealing with a malignant narcissist. He will never represent anyone's interests but his own, and he doesn't care about other people, so stop doing that.
By the way, you know what David Gergen, one time was on TV with me, pointed out to me, and not it sounds like it was an arrogant thing. It wasn't, because we were talking about narcissism off the air. He wrote a piece, maybe the first of its kind, in 2015 about candidate Trump talking about how he suffered from whatever the medical term for narcissism is. People should Google it on the CNN website, CNN.com. It's actually brilliant.
Well, don't forget, most Republicans were opposed to his candidacy until he prevailed. And then they all did it. And Lindsey Graham,
Mitt Romney, et cetera, et cetera.
Example, and they just have sucked under. But I get why people voted him for the first time around. I really do. Because I think that I know you loved Hillary. But
here
I don't think she was the best candidate. I think
you might want to stop unless we have another hour.
Okay. Well, she was.
Well, she's going to run again. We'll have another chance to talk about it.
You know, when you looked at the polls, and I'm not saying they're right, but she had a people did not like her.
They were the two most disliked candidates for president.
People
ever.
Were told not to like her.
Here we go.
If the massive disinformation campaign, I told you, we were canvassing for her in New Hampshire in a well-to-do area, in a cul-de-sac, middle-class people, and people answered the door, and when we mentioned her name, told us that she and Bill Clinton had murdered 72 people. They were getting that because they were getting their news from a Facebook feed, and that was being fed by. And these were people with seemingly, anyway, money and education. So, you know, polls are reflective. Like I said, people answer questions, including those in polls, based on the information they have in the moment that the question is asked. And people were fed an enormous amount of disinformation that they willingly chose to believe and not educate themselves. But that was reflected clearly in the polls. And she still won by over 3 million votes. So I don't want to hear it. She was voted president of this country.
If I were you, Marjorie, at this point, I would say, Andrew Cabral, thanks for being with us.
I know.
Well, are we out of time?
We are. We were out of time 5 minutes ago.
But this was a pleasure, and this was a great show on forgiveness. I think the calls,
the callers,
your discussions
were
unbelievable. Really unbelievable.
You're pretty great yourself, Andrew Cabral. Good to see you.
Okay, I'll make sure not to cross you, Andrea. Make sure to stay on the right side. Andrea Cabral joins us every week for Law and Order. She's the CEO of Ascend, the former Suffolk County Sheriff and Secretary of Public Safety. Up next, redefining intelligence. We talked to husband and wife team Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper about their incredible documentary, which challenges long-held perceptions of people with intellectual disabilities. They are next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. Disability doesn't mean impossibility. Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper made sure of that. When a neurologist told them that their son Jesse would never be, quote, intellectually normal, he and they defied that diagnosis. Jesse went on to become a Latin scholar and a poet, accomplishments that were in part the result of his parents' nonstop advocacy, which included getting Jesse enrolled in a conventional classroom setting. What inclusion can look like for persons with disabilities is the subject of this brilliant documentary film. It's called Intelligent Lives. The film will be airing on the World Channel on October 22nd at 8 p.m. as part of National Disability Employment Awareness Month. Actors and parents, in this case, Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper, are the executive producers. Chris narrates the film, which was directed by, and we're actually surprised, we didn't know he was coming, Dan Habib. Chris, Marianne, and Dan, it's great to see all three of you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Well, congratulations. Great to see you. I learned so much about the history of the rights of the disabled through your film. It was amazing. But start by telling us about your son, Jesse. You wrote a book about your son, Jesse, and you dedicated this film to him. So start with your son.
Well, Jesse was born prematurely, 2.5 months prematurely, and he had a grade 4 cerebral hemorrhage on the third day of his life, resulting in him becoming quadriplegic and nonverbal, and it was physical. We just followed him, and I was convinced that he was cognitively aware as young as 8 months because I saw him laughing appropriately at things like the chipmunks, and I thought, I think he's in there, he's there. But we then had to convince we moved to Massachusetts. We moved back
to Jersey, right?
Yeah, because inclusion was practically non-existent at the time. There was no integrated preschool then. And so he was kept separate, and we wanted him in an inclusive classroom. We wanted him to be with his peers and to learn that way. And, of course, we then moved to the one town in Massachusetts where it was not being practiced. And it meant that I had to organize the parents and get rid of the SPED director.
Special education. So, Chris Cooper, what does dusting a dresser have to do with this story? Can you please describe that to us?
Well, these are some of the questions that were asked of Jesse in his IQ test.
Right.
And who uses those terms? We just looked at Marianne and I looked at you. Just these questions are so antiquated. They're coming from what, the late the 30s, when this test was created.
Yes, Jesse had to be tested, and it was a 3-hour test without a break. He was 6 years old. He was in there with his tutor, who came out and said, "Give me a cigarette." And I said, "You don't smoke." I did at the time. And she said that he never, not only did he ask him questions like, "Jesse, do you dust a dresser?" Well, you know, mommy didn't dust, daddy dusted, and we called them bureaus, and we never asked our quadriplegic son to dust. And he then would ask him to point to something, and when he'd be about to tame his wavering arm to point to it, he would flip it over and go on to the next thing. So, of course, it was impossible to, and this was taxpayer money to do this, to keep him out of school. That's what was enraging to me.
Well, Chris Cooper, one of the things that the film talks about is that there's all sorts of different kinds of intelligence, and you illustrate this through the three people you really focused in on.
Yes, we did, I tried to, we incorporated a little history of Jesse and
and a lot of history of the disabled rights movement, yes. which a lot of us, I think, learned a lot about.
Well, you talked about how everybody was institutionalized in these horrific places for many, 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 many years, and talked about the involvement. And I was glad, you know, we always talk about the Kennedys. It's always the men that you've mentioned, that Eunice Kennedy, who probably had more of an impact on the world when you think about it, was starting Special Olympics and her understanding, because of her sister Rosemary, who was also sent away to an institution, all the wonderful things she did. But why should we play a little sound?
I want to get Dan involved in this conversation. First of all, before we play sound...
I didn't see you over
there. Oh, you're over there, Dan.
Good to be here. I'm all the way over here.
How did the three of you hook up? What's the connection
here? So there's a great organization in Massachusetts called the Federation for Children with Special Needs. And Marianne and Chris have been involved for many years. They have a foundation. They have a, you know, charitable giving through there in honor of Jesse. So we were at a banquet together maybe 9 years ago and just started talking and realized about Jesse's story was very much like my own story as a parent and my wife. We have a son, Samuel, who's in college and has a great social circle and is working and also has cerebral palsy and uses a wheelchair and uses a communication device. So we thought we had so much in common. And so we would visit socially, but about 5 years ago when I started working on this film, I thought, wow, we really need to tell that historical story. We need people to understand that people with disabilities have been systemically marginalized, forcibly sterilized, institutionalized. A lot of people don't know that history. And so I thought, wow, wouldn't it be great if I can get Chris to narrate that part? And then through really working together with Marianne and the book she wrote, we thought, let's also share Jesse's story and show what a paradigm shifter Jesse was, and then think about who are the new paradigm shifters that we can feature in the film.
Well, Naomi, Micah, and Nair, I mean, you couldn't have, if they had been delivered from some place to you, you couldn't have picked better. And they each have their own separate story. They're all young adults. Speaking of teaching, Micah becomes a teaching assistant. He talks about having heard when he was a little kid that he had a 40 IQ and what limitations that would be.
Right.
Here is a clip that is for the ages from the Intelligent Lives documentary where Micah's trying to navigate the dating world. Here is Micah.
Yeah, Micah's been going on OkCupid chatting with women.
Samantha, she's 25 and lives in Syracuse, New York. Down the road, maybe I'll ask, oh, do you want to meet at a coffee shop or something?
You want me to take a look at them, Micah?
Yeah.
You said I look forward to talking with you tomorrow?
Yeah.
And you haven't told her yet about your disability or anything like that, huh?
I just don't want to, like, tell her over a text message.
Right. It might be good before you guys meet. That's my opinion, at least. But...
Yeah, maybe I'll tell her over the phone.
And when he goes to the house for the date and meets the family, the parents and the brother, you can't quite tell if the brother's into this or the whole thing is actually aggravating. Can you describe that scene?
Sure. Well, I think my favorite moment is just before that scene, he has a thing called a circle of support. And he has his friends get together and advise him on dating, on relationships, on work, on school. And one of the guys says, just before he's about to meet his girlfriend's parents, don't talk about politics or religion.
That's right.
Now, I happen to know that Micah, this was in 2016, and Micah was posting about Bernie Sanders on his web, on his feed, and Hillary Clinton. So when the military dad says, so Micah, who are you voting for in the election? And Micah very deftly says, I haven't really decided that yet. So this shows his social and emotional intelligence. I mean, yeah, sure, give the guy a 40 IQ, but really look at all he's bringing to the world through his social and emotional intelligence. That's what the film is meant to show.
You know, when I first talked to you guys about this film on Greater Boston about a year or so ago, you, I don't know if caution me is the right word, but before you left, you said, make sure you say there's a lot of humor in this. And it is as powerful and as emotionally moving as it is. It is wildly funny, too. You know, Marianne, the thing that I take away, we're going to hear more from Nair and Naomi in a couple of seconds. The thing that I take away, which is both positive but depressing to me, is you mentioned that circle of support or whatever it was then. Every one of these young people had a universe of people around them, whether it was the brother of Naomi, the musician is just unbelievable, and the whole family. And in addition to family, that village, I hate that term, but that village grew and grew and grew. So the good news is, if you have that human infrastructure around you, the possibilities are amazing. But the vast majority of people don't have that. So what do you say to that family listening or that kid listening? Well, what do you do with that?
One of the things about the Federation for Children with Special Needs that we really love is that it's a parent-to-parent organization. So if you're a warrior mother or father, you're going to find other warrior mothers there. They give workshops on how to advocate for your child. You can learn that stuff. You can, even if you feel like you're, you know, I mean, we have set up a fund called the Jesse Advocacy Fund, which is for people of low income and English as a second language. Thinking of my own immigrant mother, what it would have been like for her to hear people using acronyms and terms she didn't understand, she would have given up.
To put the Federation as a wider and opening network to parents and children, but absolutely true. But I kept walking away time and time again from watching this film, and it is the word we don't often like to use, but it is a village. It is the immediate community that can come and help, assist, and make things work. I don't know how else you do it.
It's true. Jesse's little friend in the first grade who came back and said, you know, what's nonverbal to his mother? And she said, she explained, he said, but Jesse can talk. They just don't listen.
You know, but there's another thing. I think, Chris, this is part of your narration. I can't remember where I learned it in the film. But, you know, when people are converted to the notion that inclusion is the way to go, I think most people who get there say, well, that's great for the kid who's included, who had been essentially a victim of segregation. But you make the point, we're talking about Jesse's friends. I think a girlfriend you mentioned in one case, a friend, about what inclusion meant for those who didn't have disabilities, who... Jesse entered the world of. Fill us in a little bit on.
I wish you probably better remember some of Kyle's quotes.
Kyle was
his best friend, who is now a linguist.
He's now getting his PhD in language. Language, and he was best friends with this boy who was nonverbal. And Jamie, his girlfriend, teaches music to children. She's a teacher.
Jesse was very eclectic with in one particular thing. He was very eclectic with his music. I think he introduced a lot of different music to his friends in one respect.
I think that, you know, one of the things I love about the World Channel and the America Reframed series is they focus so much on diversity in its greatest sense. And disability is not always talked about as part of our natural diversity. We talk about race, gender, sexual orientation, all very important. Disability needs to be part of that communication because unless you grow up in a truly diverse environment by ability, you're not having the kind of experiences that you have if you're in school with Samuel or Jesse or Nair or Micah.
It makes a huge difference. I never went to school with people with disabilities or... Even people
and the real
races.
World is full of people with disabilities. Right. You need to be prepared for that.
Can we get introduced to Naomi for a second, too? Here she is being shown how she's learning how to do some cashier kind of deal. And here's one of the helpers, and then you'll hear this incredible woman, Naomi. Here it is.
A quarter. The big one. Now, another one of these. Yeah.
63 cents.
63 cents. There you go.
I'm smart.
You are smart. You're doing it by yourself.
How much do I owe you, sweetie? What's your name, by the way?
Naomi.
So you give him back two. And his change, a quarter, a dime.
Dime?
Yeah.
Thank you, Naomi.
You're welcome.
You know, the thing that made me melt, that I'm so smart thing, but when she walks out of, I think, is her first day, is it the Empire Beauty School? Is that what it's called? Where she's being trained? When she's in the parking lot and she says, I'm going to cry. Yeah. She says, I'm so happy. I mean, it just is out of nowhere.
She gets a job.
No one is saying to her, are you happy? How you feeling? Yeah. She just spontaneously. It's just.
And I think the backstory in that is really worth mentioning, in that she was in a high school in Providence, Rhode Island, that inside this high school, there was a sheltered workshop, meaning that people with disabilities, students with disabilities, were being asked to work for little or no pay instead of being in math and science and English. The U.S. Department of Justice sued Rhode Island and cited Naomi's high school as the case study in awfulness. Really? And Naomi went from there as a high school student to transitioning into a real job. And that's happening around the country. So Naomi's story is really a microcosm for some big national trends.
We're talking to Chris Cooper, Marianne Leone, and Dan Abib, are the people behind this absolutely spectacular film. It is called Intelligent Lives, and it's going to be on the World Channel on October 22nd.
Let's hear a little bit about Nahir, too. Excuse me, I have a bad voice today. All these great shots of Boston and all the great shots, again, when Chris was talking about needing that group around you, his family obviously was incredible. But tell us a little bit about his story.
Dan?
Well, I'll just set up, and then Marianne and Chris can join in. I mean, he goes right down the road here from our studios. He goes to the Henderson School in Boston, which is known nationally as one of the most inclusive public high schools in the country. Kids with significant disabilities are included in regular education. And it's a primarily non-white school. It's not a high income. So there's really not correlation between economics and inclusion from what we're seeing. Nahir is a gifted artist. He also has autism. He has some behavior challenges. And his family is concerned, understandably, that outside that bubble of Henderson, when a tall black man with some unpredictable behaviors is out in Boston, how are the police going to react? How are other people going to react? So that actually became a surprisingly large theme in the film, this idea of intersectionality between race and society's perception of disability. So I don't know if Marianne or Chris want to add to that.
I just thought their family was so wonderful and loving and... And his work, his artwork is spectacular.
It's fantastic.
It's beautiful, yeah. We bought one of his paintings.
There were some incredible scenes of him on a very superficial level. Let me point out, he was an extraordinarily beautiful-looking young man.
He is.
And when the film, near the end, when he's sitting on the subway looking at the camera, but there was another moment where he's told that he's going to be able to study sculpture.
Yes.
And can you describe the expression on his face?
He looked lit from within.
Yeah.
He was lit from within.
It was an incredible scene.
It was so beautiful.
He was ecstatic to learn he was going to be able to go to school and learn sculpture.
Yes. It was the same look on Naomi's face when she came out of the,
Empire Beauty
School.
And just to say, Nahir's now taking classes at Mass College for Art. Because of the high expectations and support he had at Henderson, he's now in college. So there's a through line there to some really wonderful things.
So where are we on the inclusion front? And, I mean, you, again, trace this disgraceful history, Chris, in your narration. Where are the laws in general? I know it's hard to generalize. Where are we?
I'll tell you, I would Dan certainly has his hands on it, but I dare say things change with things go either up or down with each administration.
That's
in
right.
A big way.
Yeah, and we're not
federal.
Federal, or
state?
Both.
State by state, and you know we're not in the trenches anymore. But I can see just in our local school, unless you're on it every minute.
They will backtrack.
I will say the Mass Department of Ed has been very engaged in this film. They're sending it out all across the state and using it as a resource to promote inclusion. But as Chris said, at the federal level, I mean, the laws are still intact. We still have the Americans with Disabilities Act, the Individuals with Disability and Education Act, IDEA. But if you don't enforce them,
that's right,
it's not going to happen. And I could just say, in as apolitical way as I can, they're the the priority of the U.S. Department of Justice is not on enforcing these laws right now. They've got their hands in other things.
Well, you also, I can't remember if it's in the open or the end, you talk about statistics, essentially 85% unemployment for people with intellectual disabilities. What is it, only 40% of those with intellectual disabilities graduate from high school?
And only 17% are included.
So while these three are really powerful, uplifting stories about what can and should be, the reality is not Naomi, Nair, and Micah at all, Dan.
Right. It's a filmmaking choice. You know, do you show some models of excellence so that other people can emulate them and also see the structures around them that help them be successful? This doesn't happen by accident, these stories. They're because of high expectations, really well-thought-out schools and workplaces. And in Jesse's case, Marion and Chris had to fight for high expectations, right? It didn't just come easily.
Oh, yeah.
We're talking about intelligent lies with Marianne Leone, Chris Cooper, and Dan Habib. Chris, tell us a little bit about more Jesse, your son, Latin scholar, poet. Again, things you might not think with his issues he'd be able to do, and obviously he excelled at them.
Like I said, Jesse would often cite examples. Jesse would often be the first person to get the joke around the adult table. His taste in music, I think we had maybe eclectic. I had a lot to do with that, but he quite enjoyed his music.
What do you like?
Eclectic, loved everything because I introduced him to opera, you know.
Right. We played opera while we made cookies, you know.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh.
Gosh, I mean, and Brandy, who came into his life, our aide, who stayed with us for years. I mean, I think he changed her life.
She said, "I didn't pay attention in high school, and I'm learning things now." Being his aide,
you quoted one of his poems about what it meant to him to be a poet at the end of the film. Do you remember what you said?
No, fill me in. What I said.
He talked about that. That he was a poet. I'm paraphrasing now. He said something like,
The world here is my...
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Here's my words. Yeah. It's hard to talk about. Sometimes it's hard to quote him and say his poems. We have to prepare to do that. We have to do actor tricks to get through
certainly,
that.
Yeah, my good
days. You should be good at that, the two of you, I guess.
No, sometimes Marianne goes public far, far more than I do. And then in my case, it's like I have good days and bad days where I can talk about him. And some days
you just lost it. He just lost it at the Toronto Film Festival. We were talking about Fred Rogers and his inclusion of children with disabilities.
Yeah, that's a great point.
You know, because
before that, Chris was like, what can I say about Fred Rogers? I mean, we didn't watch him. I said, well, what's important to us is that he included children. I mean, he had a kid in a wheelchair user on his show early on. So Chris is up on the box talking to whoever's got the mic in his face and loses it completely. So,
well, we talked about this a little bit before, but what difference it makes when you are in the second grade and third grade and fourth grade with a classroom where there are kids different ranges, how it impacts your whole life.
It does, because they're not otherized. They're not the other. And there's basically, there's sometimes, and you get it from the adults too. You know, you can feel fear if the adults are acting fearful around it or they're otherizing that child. That's going to translate right to you. But if you're there if it's absolutely normal to have that kid in the class with you, that's the message you're going to take.
You know, and I was just doing a presentation yesterday in Boston at Wellington, big wealth management company, and showing some clips of the film. And I told them what a teacher told me once. They said, here's what Samuel's taught your classmates, his classmates. He's taught them empathy. He's taught them collaboration. He's taught them to be innovative and to find all different ways to communicate and leadership. What are the skills that businesses are looking for in this world? Collaboration, innovation, leadership, communication.
That's
so
great.
These intangible skills are so critical that we need to identify them and say that's what you get when you're in a truly diverse
But
classroom.
Is the nodding, and I assume there's a lot of nodding, like up and down, mm-hmm. just like you're doing and I'm doing, is it followed by action? Or?
Well, they brought me in to continue to push their inclusive culture, this very big business. I was at Allstate, which is a big insurance company, mm-hmm. recently, same thing. So I think businesses are seeing more and more, through pressure, that they have to see disability as part of the diversity of the workplace. And it doesn't just happen. It needs to be a proactive activity.
And Dan, alongside that, you in several outings we've all had together, you bring up this one particular southern state that was very impoverished.
Sure.
That was very successful in
I was in Mississippi filming on the Mississippi Delta for another project. And people often say, oh, we can't do inclusion because we can't afford it. I say, listen, I was in a community with a less than $20,000 a year family median income, 100% free and reduced lunch, 100% African-American. They were doing inclusion beautifully. If they can do it in Mississippi, believe it, you can do it in Newton and Brookline and towns around Boston.
But let me just say, I know I speak for Marjorie, and I said it to you before. You tell the story of Naomi and Nair and Micah and Jesse so beautifully and so powerfully. So we thank you all, and I know we urge everybody out there to make sure they see this thing on World Channel. It is great.
And,
it is great.
And when you saw how Naomi was so embraced by the place that she
loved
went to
it.
Work, that was a great scene, too. The whole beauty salon, the customers,
every
the
worker,
that
every
there.
Customer is great.
So it was a picture of great success.
Congratulations to
you.
All three of you. It's great.
Thank you so much.
And
for
you also
you.
Make the best lemon squares of anybody. I mean, let's get down to what matters to me. Do you
make
know
some
what I
other
mean,
things,
Marianne?
Too.
It's good to see all three of you.
Thank you so much for having us.
Intelligent Lives will be airing on the World Channel on October 22nd at 8 p.m. as part of National Disability Employment Awareness Month. It's a great documentary. You will love it. Marianne Leone and Chris Cooper are the executive producers. It's narrated by Chris Cooper and it's directed by Dan Habib. Marianne Leone is also the author of Jesse, A Mother's Story. Marianne, Chris, Dan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For coming in. Up next, we talk to Paul Revel about the Harvard admissions verdict. He joins us for that and more next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3 to go over the latest education headlines is Paul Revel. Paul's professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education. He also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His new book, co-authored with Elaine Weiss, is Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Hello, Paul Revel.
Hello, Jim and Marjorie. Happy October.
And
thank
you.
Thank you very much, Paul Revel. Well, Harvard guy, explain the significance of this Harvard ruling on affirmative action. What does it mean?
Well, it appears to be a ruling in progress, so I don't know that this is the final word. But at least initially what it seems to say is that, there's still a place for universities to make a choice above a certain line of qualification in building a balanced class that reflects more of the realities of the outside world so as to better prepare our young people for civic life and leadership in a real world that's very diverse. And so if there are elements of selection that come into that give consideration to factors of diversity that, as the Supreme Court held some time ago, that's okay. And Harvard wasn't discriminating against Asian American students. That case was not made to the satisfaction of the judge. And on the affirmative action aspect of this case, the judge said, well, that's kind of settled law at this point. And therefore, while Harvard's admission system isn't perfect, and we do know that there are lots of biases in there relative to legacies and sports and a relationship to donors that I think came to light in this process and ought to be remedied, although that wasn't what the case was about. The case settled. The judge ultimately said Harvard's process, while not perfect, was good enough to pass muster.
Well, and you can, I think you were intimating this a second ago, at least the case really wasn't about affirmative action, at least to me, even if, well, let me get the whole sentence out, I guess, even though that's what the plaintiffs wanted it to be, because the Supreme Court has already spoken that race may be a factor, may not be the predominant factor. And so the question is, would I assume, before this Alison Burroughs, this judge, considering that that Supreme Court standard is there, does the Harvard admissions policy violate that standard? It wasn't questioning affirmative action. It was saying, does the affirmative action standard set by the Supreme Court, at least as of the moment, is it violated or comported with by Harvard? That was the case, right?
Okay. Right, that's right.
And so does this have... In your world, in the education world, are admission directors who believe in diversity breathing a sigh of relief, or do they say this is unique to Harvard and really has nothing to do with this? What's the impact of this thing?
Well, I think, again, as I started, I think this is sort of a work in progress. People know this is going to be appealed, and there are other cases, and there are folks going after the notion that you could give race any consideration in college admissions and so forth. And so I think the country is still... in the middle of a pretty vigorous dialogue on that, and that's not quite settled. So,
but that would require the Supreme Court to basically overrule its own precedent
And this isn't the only case. There are other cases. But to me, a lot of this is the way in which you frame this set of this issue and the set of issues that goes along with this. And I look at places like Harvard. Harvard could fill its class many times over with people who've got perfect scores on SATs. Mm. So this isn't a competition with a fixed finish line. And with a set of criteria that are so clear and obvious that you can judge who's at the who's first, who's second, who's third. A lot of people like to do that with respect to test scores and with grades, but it's more than test scores and grades that admissions folks are looking for. They're looking for in the admissions process the students who can do the work and be successful in the environment. And there are a lot of students who apply to Harvard who can do that, way more than we can possibly accept. So once you get above that line, how do you then make decisions about who has the right to enter or not?
Well, wasn't that part of the case of the Asian American plaintiffs was that those more subjective standards, my words, not theirs, were unfairly applied to them? Is that not part of what they're arguing?
Right. I think that's part of it. And it's a question of how you set up and how transparent that process is. I mean, there were other things that weren't litigated here, such as, is it fair to give preference to donors? Or does the government have the right to regulate whether Harvard does that or not? In other words, Harvard's a private institution. It gets government support. But so does it have a right to favor the children of alums? Does it have the right to favor people who are athletes, particularly athletes in obscure sports in which there isn't diverse participation in the first place? So therefore, it tilts in one way. The
ski
something
team.
Like 43% of the incoming class got consideration by virtue of sports or donor relationships or legacies.
43%?
Yeah, there's a very significant figure.
There was this great piece, you probably saw it, that was in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, talking about a low-income kid from Trinity College writing about how difficult it was to be a low-income kid at Trinity College and pointing out in a broader sense that is a real, because it... colleges are such an incentive to take kids that can pay full freight or take wealthy kids from overseas that are going to pay full freight. So you have a kid from a tough neighborhood who gets to college and is totally isolated and overwhelmed.
Well, it's been a huge issue at Harvard, too, by the way.
Well, it's at all the Ivies and the Ivy Plus, that top 10 group of schools. Take more than two-thirds of their two-thirds of their freshman class from the top quintile and typically less than 5% from the bottom quintile. I mean, Princeton's the worst. Princeton,
I mean, money-wise.
Yeah, Princeton has this scholarship. They say anybody who can come irrespective of financial background. They have 2.5% or roughly that in the lowest quintile and 70-plus percent in the upper quintile. So there's no balance, right? Of the family background. So if you come there as a kid, like the one you were citing at Trinity, you're in a very small minority in a culture that's dominated by the upper echelon of society, and it's easy to feel completely lost in that environment.
We're talking to Paul Revel. So Paul, there was a piece we read this morning suggesting that high school sports don't inhibit academics. The argument was made by the author that there is evidence that they help them. Who's right here? And that was responding to a piece that was suggesting the opposite. Who's right here?
Well, I think high school sports certainly advantage you relative to prospects and, for example, job applications. We know that a number of employers go right to whether you've been, once you've hit a certain level of prestige in the school that you went to and you've passed all the other factors. I typically have this experience. You run into an employer at a cocktail party and say, well, okay, you've got the pick of the lot. Who do you pick? And they'll say, I pick people who've been on sports teams because I want them to have this sort of collaboration and work as a team and make sacrifices for the group and have their performance measured and so on and so forth. And when you look at access to sports, it's now also starting to reflect, social capital and privilege. So there was an interesting article recently that said that for the first time in 30 years, participation in sports in American high schools has gone down. And the last time it went down, it was when that demographic was going down because of a temporary sort of birth drop. But now it's up. This is the first time it's ever gone down while the population mm-hmm. is still going up. And the attribution of that, it's in part football. So a number of people are not playing football because they're worried about the concussions and brain damage. But it's much, much more in a wide variety of other areas where, students are getting so specialized in the sports that they're involved in. So you invest deeply in one sport, and typically students get on traveling teams, which they pay fees
to be on.
Yeah, very expensive. They drop out of all the other sports. The schools, therefore, don't have as much participation in those sports. So poor kids who can't be on the traveling teams or can't go to the summer sports camps. And so now it's changing. Even there was a statistic in that article about, in Division I basketball teams, the number of students who were the first people in their family to go to college 10 or 20 years ago was 28%. Now it's down to just 1 in 7. So at even the very top levels of competition in a sport that's relatively accessible by comparison with squash, let's say,
Where do you go to play squash? Actually, I'm not sure.
You're sort of giving extra privilege to those who've had the opportunity to do sports.
But let me be clear, back to my original question. The point I was trying to make inartfully was not so much that sports advantages you after the fact because it's an extra thing when you're playing. The contention of these authors was that schools with strong athletic programs also have higher test scores and lower dropout rates while the kids in school, that they sort of work hand in hand. Do you buy that?
I think there's something to that. I mean, in lived experience, one of the reasons that young people come to school is things that they're passionate about that connect them to the school and give them a reason. For many kids, they're not first and foremost drawn to the academic agenda, but because they're drawn to the theater club or the chorus or the band, or in many cases, sports teams, they come to school, and because their coaches tell them they got to hit a certain grade in order to participate, they've got added pressure to get involved in academics, which is, again, what concerns me. When you look at the number of schools that are eliminating organized sports, it's much more common in low-income schools than it is in upper-income
schools. So that's building in, yet again, your point. Privilege and the achievement gap.
So Paul Breville, our education man, The Globe reported a while back, James Vances, who covers education, that the state is now going to review the Boston public schools.
That's right.
Which I find kind of exciting because the state did review take over the Lawrence public schools and did a wonderful job. Boston is obviously a lot bigger, but we've had a lot of bad news coming out of the Boston public schools with the valedictorians and the fact that they don't have the high level of. Yeah. And now you find that the reaction, and I guess it makes sense, the MCAS has gotten harder. Kids are doing worse. I hope that means it's just because of the test and not because they're learning even less, but they're not going to be prohibited from graduating, I guess, if they don't pass this.
Well, they've lowered the bar. I mean, on the MCAS, they've introduced a new test, which is more difficult. They temporarily lowered the bar for what they consider an acceptable level of achievement for anyway, an adjustment period.
What could this mean for Boston schools?
Well, I mean, it could mean a number of things. Number one, I think, and I think the superintendent was wise in welcoming Commissioner Riley and his team from the department to come in. I think that any time you can get sort of high-quality feedback from peers in the field about how you're performing, it's helpful. I think the Commonwealth will have some decisions. The State Department of Ed will have some decisions to make about, you know, the volume of underperforming schools and the degree of severity of problems in those schools. So it might well result in a more aggressive approach to taking over either individual schools or providing guidance to the system, because the preponderance of performance problems in Boston is fairly high. So it remains to be seen what the outcomes will be. But, you know, we have long festering. I mean, if you just take the Madison Park case, that's been an acknowledged long festering problem in Boston that I can remember Mayor Menino 2 or 3 years before he left signaling in his State of the City addresses in a couple of years in a row, we're going to solve this problem. And it's proved to be intractable or insoluble.
You know what I wonder?
Maybe state takeover wouldn't be such a bad thing.
We should be clear, though. You're both, it sounds to me, acting it like the reason they're taking a look at the Boston schools is because of the problems. At least the Globe story, and you would know this better than us, Paul, this is sort of a normal cycle where the state examines every school system, and it's Boston's turn. The last time was 10 years ago.
Not every school system, do they?
I don't know.
Well, no, they prioritize systems that are having some difficulty.
Oh, they do? Okay.
Yeah.
And I think there's a real interest at the state level in wherever there's a high level of underperformance, and Boston happens to have a very high level.
Okay,
you know what I wonder is you hear a lot this anecdotally, people complaining about the heavy-duty administrative, you know, the central office in Boston schools, and there's a lot of money spent there on administration. I don't know if that's true because I haven't looked at it myself, but you wonder whether you almost need the state to come in to have the power and the political capital to make dramatic changes, because I think it's probably very difficult for a superintendent to do that.
Oh, yeah. It's very difficult at the local level to make some of the changes that need to be made. And so that's where the state can be helpful. However, you know, it's more typical in most communities, the school bureaucracy and school leadership and school boards, as well as mayors, typically resist state involvement. Now, they're not going to come in and change anything in the near term. They're going to come in and do a report. And then that report is going to have some recommendations, which recommendations may be just pure recommendations to folks on the Boston School Committee and Boston School Administration about what to do to improve the situation. And it could conceivably be recommendations to the State Board of Education to say we need to move more aggressively in doing some things with Boston that they may not want to do. Where I'm in Boston's situation, I'd welcome the assistance. I mean, this is what we have going on in Providence right now.
Does the school
system
reviewed get a chance to heal itself before?
Sometimes. It depends.
Not always.
Not always. You know, it is possible that you'd have a report where the state would say, we're going to come right in immediately because we think you need assistance, and we're going to give you assistance over a period of time. I mean, don't forget, Commissioner Riley's a former leader in the Boston Public Schools, so he understands the Boston Public Schools well. So given that he was also the person who was the receiver and the superintendent up in Lawrence, I think he understands this kind of situation quite well. And he's known for restraint. So I don't expect something cataclysmic to happen here. But I wouldn't be surprised if the state were to step up and say, we need some significant changes in Boston. You know, you've got a superintendent and school committee who have a strategic plan to do some things in that direction. So we'll see what happens.
I see it,
Paul Revel. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Paul Revel joins us regularly. He's a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His new book, co-authored with Elaine Weiss, Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Thank you very much, Paul. Up next, what can the Green New Deal learn from the original FDR's New Deal? Harvard historian Nancy Kane joins us for that next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. In February, Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Senator Ed Markey announced their Green New Deal, a vast and visionary plan to respond to the urgency of climate crisis.
Climate change defines our existence. Global temperatures are the highest in recorded history. Wealth inequality is at its highest point since the era of the Great Depression. The erosion of our coastlines, the erosion of the earning power of workers, the pollution of our planet, the pollution of our democracy by big oil and Koch brother financing. The interrelationship of these ills and injustices is undeniable. But the challenge is not insurmountable.
Well, to ensure that this challenge is not insurmountable, are there lessons to be learned from how FDR responded to the financial calamity of the Great Depression by way of his New Deal? Here with us in Studio 3 for her take on this is Harvard historian Nancy Kane. Nancy holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book is Forged in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Hello, Nancy Kane.
Hey there.
Hey, well, this is a fascinating thesis that AOC and the Green New Deal, Ed Markey, our senator here, who's the co-sponsor, should look at what FDR did. And apparently FDR went very local in his convincing people that this was the way to go. What did he do?
Well, his cabinet, it's really his cabinet, and lots of outside experts, right? They, like John Kennedy's administration, FDR pulled freely from all kinds of folks in the early years and actually throughout his almost four terms as president. They created a whole host of programs. It was called Alphabet Soup at the time, right? Because there were so many different programs, right? From the WPA to the CCC to the TVA. That's the Works Progress Administration, the Civilian Conservation Corps, and the Tennessee Valley Authority, just to name three prominent programs. These programs, which were federally instigated, federally created, federally funded, were actually reached all the way down to the local level. So, you know, there were, if you will, you know, teenagers and unemployed adults working in all kinds of places to, you know, plant trees, build New Salem, which is a historic site near and dear to my heart in central Illinois, which was a reconstruction with lots of CCC help, reconstruction of a village that Abraham Lincoln spent pivotal years in. It is now a National Park Service site and a historic site. The tentacles, if you will, or the reach of these programs was both broad, right, and deep. And although critics of the New Deal, these are historians and politicians, as you know, in our own time, criticizing the New Deal for lacking a kind of comprehensive strategic plan, although you know people have criticized that, the one of the most important aspects of both the FDR's New Deal and Senator Markey and Representative Ocasio-Cortez's Green New Deal, two of the most important unifying aspects of these were, one, they galvanized people's attention on the issue of, to take the New Deal, unemployment and job and wage security. And just like the Green New Deal in its first, right, 6 months of amorphous life has galvanized discussion and people's attention on the, you know, the extraordinary urgency and comprehensive nature of climate change. And two, they were calls to action. See, I think that is really important here. And that hasn't been written about a great deal in a number of articles that are comparing these two, in one case, a set of resolutions, and in another case, a set of programs. That hasn't been really mentioned, which is each of these sets of initiatives called people to action and said, look, the Great Depression and what it means economically and politically for the United States is a huge deal, and we're going to throw everything we have at it in terms of federal government resources to solve it and to deal with it and to keep people, right, from the desperate ravages of unemployment and starvation. And in many ways, these two sponsors, Markey and Ocasio-Cortez, are trying to do exactly the same thing. They're saying, look, this is not just about battling the extraordinary difficulties and challenges of climate change. It's also about, we're going to create a lot of new jobs in doing this. We're going to affect all kinds of communities in positive ways, but it's a big deal, and Americans at all levels are going to be involved.
So can I ask a couple of things about what you said? Was FDR conscious of how important a local component was to its success, or did it just have a local component and it benefited? You know what I mean? Was it like a conscious strategy, or did he fall into the strategy and it ended up causing there to be widespread support on the bottom? You know what I mean?
Yes, I do. It's a good question. And I suspect it's a little bit of both, but there's no question. This is a master politician, right? I mean, in many ways, the most important legacy of the New Deal, the most important impact, and there were many specific impacts, including the kind of, you know, plethora of legislation like the Securities and Exchange Act, right? Like the creation of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, right? The greatest legacy was in some ways a political settlement. Right? FDR said, I couldn't get over this. This is in one of the articles. Bear with me, dear listeners. FDR said, individual freedom cannot exist without economic security and independence. People who are hungry and out of a job are the stuff of which dictators are made. So in many, many ways, the New Deal was a political settlement designed, in some sense, to save democracy and capitalism from the reaches of fascism, which was spreading rapidly in the 1930s and very much related to the Great Depression. So I think he knew, Jim, that this has got to be for the man in the lunch line, for the man in the soup line. But secondly, this thing turned out, again, to have, I suspect, unexpected local reach and relevance. And that was, in some sense, an unintended benefit of mm-hmm. the program because, you know, my grandparents could tell you about how the New Deal affected them and their towns.
So one other thing about messaging, I'm curious to know how FDR did. I mean, the good news for him is he didn't have social media. I mean, I don't know this for a fact. My guess is if you stopped 50 people in the street and said, tell us the things you know about the Green New Deal, right. Most would say, I think we're not allowed to eat hamburgers anymore, right. And we're outlawing planes.
Right.
And
right.
So the messaging, I would argue, the big messaging has been fine. The details, which I think often matter, has been, in my opinion, atrocious. Right. But what was the messaging like on this? I mean, obviously, there were not a multiplicity of voices like there are now.
No, that's right.
So what was FDR's messaging
well,
like?
Well, let's remember, this is the man who began the fireside chat.
Of course,
right?
That's
and all
right.
all the presidential communications that followed from a president, a chief executive reaching directly out to the American people intimately, right, on a regular basis. So he was controlling a lot of the messaging. Now, remember, dear listeners, that he had extraordinarily, you know, angry and vocal critics. I mean, you know, bankers hated him. All kinds of business people hated him because he was stretching the arm of the government into regulating business. FDR once said, the financial industry and all the bankers hate me, and I welcome their hate.
Oh, I love that line.
I mean, so again, someone, a master politician. So he had critics from all sides, but to your opening comment, Jim, they didn't have Twitter, right? They didn't have Fox News. They didn't have $10 million to spend on a Facebook ad, mm-hmm. right, to say, look at why the Civilian Conservation Corps is destroying your life or taking away your cows and your airplanes. So it was much less complicated than even with an eager and vocal opposition press, for example.
Well, you know what I also wonder about, too? There was massive unemployment, obviously, during the Great
25%
Depression.
25% in 1933.
And now the Trump administration, one of their great achievements, obviously we have very low unemployment now. So you wonder about that you know, when you read about a lot of these jobs with the fossil fuel companies, right. They pay pretty good money.
Right.
And even coal mining, which is a very dangerous job, right. Pays good money. So how do you make that transition to the green jobs? And there's a certain macho appeal to fossil fuels and coal that I'm not sure transfers to solar panels. And you know what I mean?
I think the bigger challenge is the first one. The macho appeal is there, but that's fast waning in the increasing right awareness of global public opinion about the dangers of fossil fuels. So, but the first piece is a really important piece. I mean, think about the GM strike right now. Think about the original equipment manufacturers that affect, you know, thousands, not just 46,000 GM workers. Those people are lobbying for good jobs. They are fighting to improve what are good jobs relative to lots of white-collar work. I mean, relative to lots of blue-collar work or manufacturing work. So your point, I think, is spot on. The onus, then, on not just people like, not just congressmen and government public servants in support of something like the Green New Deal, but on many, many others, including all of us that think that we need collective widespread action now, is to in a sense tell the story of clean energy, what it means, what the job creation possibilities are, what the salaries attached to those new jobs are, and what the effect on communities is. Because that story, which has begun to be fleshed out with good data, is actually a very compelling story as well. Very, very compelling. And yet, back to Jim's point about what we know and don't know, what's true and what's not true about something like a Green New Deal, most people don't know anything about that, right? So we got to talk about that. I mean, because solar panel jobs are good jobs.
So, Nancy, another thing that it appears to me is missing from the Green New Deal, and I don't know how they fix this, is I read a piece a couple of weeks ago. We thought we were going to discuss this with you, and then right. some emergency happened in the news, which was, I guess...
It was impeachment.
They're all... It was...
Yeah, I remember it very clearly because Chelsea texted me a few hours before.
That's right.
That damn impeachment every time. Yeah. In any case, I looked this up about... And I know you know this, but I didn't know this. There was a Republican, prominent Republican senator from Nebraska who signed on to the Tennessee Valley Authority. Yeah. The La Follette, who obviously is legendary out of Wisconsin, was part of, I don't know if it was a Civilian Conservation Corps, but another couple. There was at least, at worst, minimal high-profile Republican support for almost all of the elements of the New Deal. There's virtually no bipartisan support for any element of the Green New Deal, so they can paint it as some radical leftist democratic thing.
That's going to take away our cows, our meat, and our airplanes. I'm going to keep coming back to that. Right? No, I think it's very
important. That was a critical part of FDR that's missing here, right?
It was, but again, there have been other moments in history when, let's remember that the New Deal ushered in, and this is important and relevant for today, ushered in a moment of government responsibility and action in a big arena, right? Mm-hmm. So one of the most important, like as I said, is political. It's also about government involvement in our economy and our society and the legitimization of that, because even though the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, did not end the Great Depression, what ended the Great Depression was the Second World War and an extraordinary mobilization on the part of the U.S. government and in working with the economy to wage that war. I mean, that was really what ended the Great Depression. The importance of the New Deal is again mostly political and social, and it should not be minimized. But here's the really relevant thing: in the 1920s, America was living through an extraordinary period of what today we would call laissez-faire attitudes toward government and the economy, or government and society. That all began to end when FDR took the oath of office in March of 1933, and it ended pretty quickly. We are today coming off a period of, you know, the erosion of all kinds of government action in the economy, from ending Glass-Steagall to the receding of the government now under Trump in, say, environmental regulation and in terms of any kind of role in really credible income redistribution, which was a huge role, which was a huge thing that the government did at various points, including, by the way, in the early 1940s, when the lowest 25% of America's incomes grew at twice the rate of the top 25%, dear listeners. So what we're talking about here is, and I think this is where we're going to need, and we're going to see, right, or we're going to have to see, a massive shift, if you will, in what's possible in terms of a political coalition across the aisle. We did that in 1933 and 34 and 35. The country went from this extreme in terms of Republican. Remember who was president in the 1920s, right? Remember Herbert Hoover is the man that FDR replaced. Right? We're going to move the country moved very rapidly from one place to another. I think it, as the United States did on slavery between 1860 and 1864, I think it's entirely possible that the United States will do something like that politically in terms of a governing, responsible coalition across party lines. But it's going to take, right, the threat of something extraordinarily dangerous and significant for that to happen, right? Like unemployment climbing to 25% and Hitler being made, right, the head of Germany in 1933.
We're talking to Harvard historian Nancy Kane. You mentioned that the New Deal did not end the Depression, but one of these stories said, I thought this was a great line, but it did enable millions to survive it, which I thought was wonderful. Great. But I wanted to know from
that's
you,
really important.
It is
right?
important. It's really important. Yeah, because people were
starving.
Survive
it both psychologically and yes. and physically, practically.
But I wanted to know, one of the big knocks, obviously, against the Green New Deal is its cost. And I wonder, back in the old New Deal, or I guess the FDR New Deal, I should call it, was this all federal government money and raising tax? Where'd the money come from?
The money came primarily from debt. It was primarily financed by debt. And
okay.
And although the federal debt and deficit, therefore, rose in the 1930s, it was nothing compared to its rise during the Second World War.
Okay.
So, and the American economy absorbed that and recovered from that, increased indebtedness, and then massive increases in that indebtedness during the conflict very nicely with significant economic growth beginning in the mid-1940s.
Because isn't that one of the problems now is that we are so terribly in debt, and this last tax cut to the most wealthy made our debt even more significant.
Yeah, but the deficit talks don't exist anymore.
No,
just
that's
like,
right. No, they've
disappeared.
I mean,
those who used to say it's an anathema
however,
for America.
But my point is, Jim, that this is that they can do a 180 and we can't have any more debt to fund the Green New Deal. I mean, they agreed with the debt because they've fallen in line with the president to fund his tax cut. I think they would just turn the argument on its
well,
on
again,
its head.
I think it's going to take, we all know this is coming, assuming the planet survives, a transformation in the Republican Party, right? That is kind of an elephant in the room.
Right.
And
we just had a transformation in the Republican Party.
Well, we may have another one if the country is to thrive, not just survive, but thrive, to Marjorie's point about the Great Depression. And so that is an important aspect, or that's, again, a specter that's very important, a possibility that's very important, and a lot depends on what happens in the next year and a half in respect to that political possibility. In terms of funding the Green New Deal, if you really look at some of the numbers about economic growth and the revenue that will occur as a result of some of these clean clean energy, those numbers are very significant. It is not clear on first blush that this is going to be anything like right. A huge increase or a debilitating increase in American federal government's indebtedness. So I think we want to get more. We want to know more about what's happening in clean energy and understand a lot of the self-funding possibilities of these aspects of, say, for example, right. Really getting to net zero emission, carbon emissions.
You know,
really understand that much better before we jump on the kind of cliched, right, oppositional, bell that says, oh my God, this is going to cripple the country with indebtedness. We're going to have to make some changes in how we spend federal money. But that's true in every single significant moment in American history when the country is faced with a, kind of defining problem, as the Great Depression was, as climate changes, and much more, and a global problem at that.
I just want to say, we talk a lot about people being apathetic in the United States and not protesting. We just had a massive climate strike by these kids that were out. It was all around the world.
Yep.
So even as Jim says, the message from the top may have been somewhat confusing. I think millions of Americans get it, and millions of people around the world get it and understand this emergency. And a lot of young Republicans, the polls show,
are now, that's
are
their most important issue.
Yes. So you have to wonder if that, even though the Republican Party has been recalcitrant, if their young voters might
could
matter.
Not agree more. Look at Greta Thunberg and how she is educating people, right? This started off a year ago as a teenage girl sitting outside the Swedish parliament on Fridays. So that the millions of people that Bill McKibben was talking about last week on the show in that wonderful conversation you three had, right? Those millions of people that possibility didn't exist a year ago. And now it's here. So we don't know what the curve or the slope of the change looks like, because we've never been here before, and we've never had such a young, right, public demanding change in such very visible, unmistakable, unavoidable ways as we do right here.
I think we have to send all our kids to the Swedish public schools. You know, one last thing, you know, and this is not in any way to minimize, obviously, how huge the New Deal was. But there were warts, too. I mean, I guess, was it the Civilian Conservation Corps? Workers were segregated in what they did. Blacks worked on some projects. Whites worked on others. No women, is that right, were part of that? Is that
very
true?
Very few.
So, and is that just dismissed as a function of the times? Or I mean, what are people like you, how do you respond to something like that?
I respond by saying that, you know, in my own Hegelian understanding of history, we get more aware and our knowledge and wisdom slowly, incrementally, two steps forward, one step back, grow, and we live in a more enlightened moment. I guarantee clean energy as it comes here will not be an all-white, all-male sport. Mm-hmm. Last point. I was in Booth Bay Harbor last weekend. I've never been there before. Rachel Carson's cottage is there.
Oh, my gosh.
So I had like a holy moment. I had a holy moment. I went to all kinds of places where she was. And I kept thinking, what would she say about this moment? What would she say if she met Greta Thunberg and they like had a cup of tea together, which they could indeed do? And I think what Rachel would say is agitate, agitate, agitate. Get the truth out to all kinds of people, including the very young who really matter more here right now than the older ones of us. Get it out and get it done and don't stop.
You know what's terrible? I thought of you and Rachel Carson because you wrote in your book about leadership about Rachel Carson. What's the name of the book? Forged in Crisis?
Crisis?
Yes. And the terrible reports about pesticides killing millions and millions of birds, a huge percentage.
Millions. Silent Spring, we're getting there. 30% of birds have disappeared in the last 50 years in North America.
From pesticides. Sorry. Yeah, and it's like we haven't learned from our history.
Rachel, we need you.
By the way, speaking of Silent Spring, since you both mentioned it 13 times in the last 2 minutes, we should mention that you are doing a major thing in an organization we love,
Silent Spring.
Silent Spring
Institute, October 23rd, later this week.
We're
this month.
We're going to be there.
October 23rd, Meredith Vieira, I think, is interviewing you about
Fireside chat about leadership and Rachel.
Silent Spring is this great Newton-based organization we've done some work with that deals with environmental chemical issues and that
cancer.
Sort of thing.
And its relationship to cancer.
Great stuff. Yep. And we're doing the auction that night. It's a great thing. October 23rd. Check it out, Silent Spring. If you're interested, great to see you, Nancy. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Thank you very much, Nancy. Harvard historian Nancy Kane holds the James E. Robison Chair of Business Administration at Harvard Business School. Her latest book is, here it is, Forge in Crisis, The Power of Courageous Leadership in Turbulent Times. Nancy Kane, thank you very much. Coming up, how I... casual conversation at Mass General turned into a band with a bent for social justice. The Fever Breakers are next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, you're lucking out on a world premiere. The band The Fever Breakers is releasing the latest track today right here in BPR. It's called I'm a Hippie. I think I actually pronounced I'm a Hip-E, actually, based on what I've read about it. It's a band that originated in the basement of Mass General Hospital. This is true. Their songs are directed at social causes. Their motto is making the world reflect one song at a time. Here with us in Studio 3 to represent The Fever Breakers are songwriter Dr. Gleason Ribello. He is a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at Mass General and an instructor at Harvard Medical School. Also conceptualizes and creates the songs with John Ventura. Nice to meet you, Doctor.
Hey, nice to meet you.
Speaking of John Ventura, he's an implant and tissue inventory specialist, whatever that is, at Mass General. He's a Berkeley grad, that I understand, and he composes the music for The Fever Breakers and does the vocals and keyboard. Nice to see you. You know what a tissue specialist is,
yes,
right?
Do.
You do. Okay, I want to be clear. And Matt Gerard is a musician and sound engineer who works out of the Revolution Sound Studio in Charlestown. He mixes and masters the song. Matt, it's a pleasure to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, well, we'll start with the two physicians here. How did this all
One physician here.
Oh, you're not two? You're both not doctors?
So I'm a surgeon in Mass General.
You're not a doctor?
I'm an implant and tissue specialist.
We heard that, actually.
I thought that made you a doctor.
No, it sounds good, though.
It sounds very good. Okay. Sorry about that.
That's okay.
Well, how did this come about, this little get-together for all you guys with this music?
So it started with, some years ago I'd operated a close family member of John's. And one day, and I was walking in the basement of the hospital, I bump into him and I said, "Hey, you look familiar. What are you doing here?" And he said, "You had operated somebody of mine." And we talked a little more about that person. And then I said, "I didn't know you worked in the Mass General." And he says, "I didn't. Well, I had some financial difficulties, and now I'm started working here. But I'm a Berklee School of Music graduate." And when I heard that, I was like, "Wow, that's something, John, for you to switch." And
have you formed a band with other family members of other patients of yours in the past, or no? You have not. I just want to be clear. Okay.
So we talked a little more, and then I said, "Anything I can do to, help you?" And he said, "I'm looking for a songwriter." And I said, "I'll write songs for you." And he said, "Do you write songs?" I said, "No, I write children's books, but, I try to write songs." And that's how we started. So I wrote something and gave it to John.
And are you the Elton John to his Bernie Taupin?
I guess.
Is that what's going on, right? I mean, you're the music guy and he's the lyrics guy. Is that not right?
Yes.
So what did you think when he made this overture to you?
Well, I thought it was something new and interesting. I had collaborated with other lyricists before, and Gleason had an idea about composing music with social issues being the subject, which was kind of different and challenging to me. So I says, it would be a good thing, a good disciplinary thing for me to do and to keep me writing. And from then we started writing. He'd give me some lyrics and tell me what he wanted, the type of style of the music. So I would, look it over, tweak it a little bit, and set some music to it.
So did Dr. Rebello operate on any of your family members or no?
Well, not yet, but, there's always time.
So how are you connected to all? I know what you do, but how did you come to be part of this Fever Breakers world?
Well, as things develop, like they're writing songs, they want to record them. Part of it is they need a place to go. So fortunately, I have a studio in Charlestown, Revolution Sound Studio, and they came in with the first song, actually it's a little over a year now, and with the kind of tasked us with, they came in as songwriters with a kind of a vague idea, an outline, and then my job is to make it sound like...
Good, yeah. Like it does.
The most important thing is we had very little time. Uh-huh. So these songs that John and I put together, put in the basement of the hospital using a piano used for music therapy, and they're done in breaks between surgeries, and we put those songs together there. John went on and found, other guys working in the hospital who were all professional musicians. And that's how we all came together. Our drummer's from Berklee. His Jonathan Ullman. I just want to shout out to him and to Zachary Anderson, who's our lead guitarist, and Fred Eugene, who's our bass guitarist.
And so is this to make you all feel better? I mean, I'm serious, by the way. Is the whole purpose of this coming together so you can live in stressful times more calmly? Is it for patients? Is it for the world? Who are you doing this for?
I think it's for everybody, really. It's a message that he wants to get out there, and we try to write different genres of music to appeal to the different audiences out there. The last song that we had just done about the hip dysplasia group is kind of a dancey, something that would be appealing to younger kids, and it is for a young group.
Can we play something else? You guys did Words Can Kill, and it's a rap sort of hip-hop song about the perils of texting and driving, which we talk about a lot.
Mm-hmm.
You had never rapped before, is that true?
I had never.
Okay, and Gleason apparently gave him a T-shirt after he sang this. Watch out, old white man rapping. So here's a little
bit
of...
Why didn't you bring that to the session?
Here's a little bit of Words Can Kill.
Watch out. My train of thought just ran him over. I didn't use a gun, yet his life is over. Now I'm in a bind, going out of my mind. Words can kill, yes, words can kill. They just did. Blood spilled, didn't intend it. Can't defend it. Shouldn't have driven and texted. I should have stayed in.
All white men can rap, apparently.
Didn't I read where you were talking about kind of having a friendship across socio-political different views, and now we can, you know, we're in the middle of this impeachment thing, and you guys can talk as friends instead of being ready to kill each other.
A little nervous smiling in this theater. Yeah, John, you respond first. Go ahead, John. That would be you.
Yes.
Is that true? You different ends of the political spectrum, you guys?
I think we both have our own views. We agree and we disagree.
So the answer is yes.
Yes.
Okay.
But you can have this great music together and it doesn't get in the way.
Never.
Yeah. That's kind of
is that true?
I love John Ventura. You know, let me just say that first. And
however.
So though we are, you know, different ends of the spectrum, I think we have a lot of things in common in terms of what we want out of life, and that's what binds us together. And that's the reason why we, you know, we wrote this song called Yes, We America, and that's a song that is nonpartisan. You know, I wouldn't call it bipartisan. It's nonpartisan.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
We wrote it with the fractured nation in mind, and
this was the final nominee for the Hollywood Songwriting Contest of 2019.
Yes, that's a big deal.
I don't mean to be incredulous, but why don't we play a little Yes, We Are America? Here's a little bit of this nonpartisan song in this toxic times. Here it is.
They could be at anybody's rally, Republican or Democrat. But I read where there was a little modification of the MAGA hat, and that caused a big uproar on Facebook.
So
what happened?
I kind of create artwork for these songs.
Yep.
And the artwork that we chose to make was the MAGA hat, but we just put Yes, We Are America on that. And it was amazing, the response. Started getting shot down from both sides, the right and the left. To the left, just kind of hated that red hat. They didn't want to read what's on it. And the right, they listened to the song and it says, "We walked across the border," and they didn't like that part.
That was it.
So your song really brought people together. That's beautiful there, Doctor. So are they any good? I mean, you're the sound guy. They sound quite good to me. Are they?
They are good. I mean, the big thing is that we don't have a lot of time. And so, you know, we come in and track a bunch of stuff and then they leave. And then I track a bunch of stuff. And, you know, the nice thing about this is we try to be as efficient as we can. You know, I mean, we're doing it for the love of it. You know, there's no money in music.
So, Matt, you're the perfect person to ask. You're the sound engineer for this group, the Fever Breakers. Could you tell Marjorie what an implant and tissue inventory specialist is?
Yeah.
Could you tell us, please?
I assume you know. I thought it started doing transplants.
What is that? Do you know?
I think John, he keeps track of if they order tissue samples or where organs go.
So is that right, John?
What we do is I have two coworkers in the office I work in, and we correspond with surgeons for upcoming cases that require implants, whether it be synthetic or human tissue donated or bone. So we keep an inventory, we manage that, and we also prep for the cases that are coming out.
So would it be hard to do a transplant in some cases? Like if someone was getting a liver transplant or
no,
a kidney
it's
transplant?
Not organ transplant. It's mostly orthopedic, but we do handle neuro and urological. So anything that's implanted in the body, shoulders, hip replacement, knee replacement.
Oh, neat.
I think I'm going to be seeing you in a couple of days, John.
I hope not.
So these are... both two of the musicians and the Fever Breakers and their sound guy are here. Do you play for patients? We had a guy who's...
I think the MGH holiday party would be a wonderful opportunity.
Or more regular. On a serious note, it seems this is great. Do you play for patients?
I don't play an instrument, but we thought about it. But frankly, I don't know if we have the bandwidth to perform.
So to speak,
exactly. Because it requires practice and... We have very little time to do this. So we pull these songs off by the seat of our pants, literally. And Matt plays a huge role there where, you know, these songs are recorded in 3 hours in the studio, and that's it. There's no more time before and after. There's no rehearsal. There's nothing.
We've never rehearsed as a group.
Is that really true? No.
Never.
So that means Gerard's got a very big job then.
Well, I mean, really the only time they play is we get the text for the session. All right, we're coming in.
Right.
All right, we're going to do it.
So you have to do a lot of cleanup, Gerard?
Really?
Matt.
I'm sorry, I'm really screwing up.
Unless he's going to call you Egan.
No, I'm screwing everything up today. Okay. I got the tissue thing wrong, the doctor thing wrong, your name wrong. But, you know, I'm sick. So, feel sorry for me.
Much sympathy. No, it's not as much cleanup, but more of filling out the production. So, again, you know, we only have so much time to just lay down what we refer to as basics. So your basic drum track, guitars, keyboards, and bass. And then from there, like in the last track, We Are America, we added like a bunch of acoustic guitars. I played a bunch of trumpet and horns on it, some extra organ parts, things that we kind of just don't have time to do in the original session. So really what I'll do is I'll take a listen to the song, kind of hear where it's going, and then I'll flush out the arrangement with whatever I feel like it's missing.
So what's the future? I'm sorry, go ahead.
What'd you do at Berkeley?
Composition and performing major.
So you did a lot of singing.
Yes,
vocals.
And playing. Yes, vocals, piano, and a lot of writing,
arrangements,
composition.
Pretty good school.
Yeah.
Fabulous
excellent
place, actually.
I've heard of it.
So what's the future of this operation here, so to speak? That was a good line, Jim. Thank you. Didn't even mean it.
So, you know, John and I wake up every morning and we say the obscurity prayer, which is like the serenity prayer. Dear God, please let our music
this
not die
true
in obscurity.
I may have to steal that.
Now that we're on your show, I hope, you know, we become superstars and get people tugging at our clothes.
Right,
and I don't think that's
going
to happen either. So, jokes aside, what I really hope is that some foundation, you know, funds us. You know, we are working on the edge of humanities and arts and science, mm-hmm. and somebody, you know, decides to fund us and let us do more of this.
We hope it happens. I think it's great. And congratulations to all of you. It's great to meet all of you, and thanks for coming in and sharing your story.
Yeah, we're going to hear a little bit of one of those songs on the way out. This is the Fever Breakers' latest release. It's I'm a Hippie, a song written as an anthem for an organization called I'm a Hippie, a Vancouver-based organization that's fighting pediatric hip diseases. This is awfully fun to talk to you guys. Songwriter Dr. Gleason Ribello, he's a pediatric orthopedic surgeon at Mass General and instructor at Harvard Medical School. John Ventura is the composer, vocalist, and keyboard player, and the implant and tissue inventory specialist at Mass General Hospital, and musician and sound engineer who works out of the Revolution Sound Studio in Charlestown is Matt Gerard. And he mixes and masters the Fever Breakers song. Thank you very much for listening to Boston Public Radio. Tomorrow, you can keep up. We're going to be at the Boston Public Library with our Friday All-Stars, Emily Rooney, Callie Crossley, Shirley Young, and Andy Anatko. What's on television, Jim Brown?
Well, Deborah Katz and Lisa Banks were two of the lawyers for Christine Blasey Ford. They're also lawyers for some of the survivors of Placido Domingo, Antonio Brown. They're getting an honor from the Victims' Rights Law Center tonight in Boston. They're going to join me to talk about where the Me Too movement is a while after Blasey Ford did what she did. Martha Minows, the former dean of Harvard Law School, she joins me. Talk about good timing with the discussion we had earlier today. She's written a new book, When Should Law Forgive? So we'll continue the conversation we began today and some other things tonight at 7 o'clock. I think it should be a pretty good show.
I want to thank our crew, Chelsea Murs, Arjun Singh, Zoe Matthews, Hannah Ubeli, Aidan Conley, our engineer, John McClough Parker. Thank you so much for tuning in. Please tune in again tomorrow and visit us at the library. I'm Marjorie.
And I'm Jim Browdy.
Have a great afternoon.
Oh, sorry. This song is Bully. I made a mistake. It's not I'm a Hippie. This is Bully. Go check them out, the Fever Breakers.